Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Here's a thought exercise. When you think about what an American farmer looks like, what comes to mind? Grizzled vet in overalls, youthful hipster in an organic cotton tee. The clothes may change, but either way, you probably didn't picture John Boyd Jr. He is the president of the National Black Farmers Association, and he's been a farmer his entire life, as was his father and his father's father and his father before him. He's here as a part of our ongoing series Black And, where we're asking people to talk with us about navigating more than one identity. And John Boyd Jr., welcome to the program. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here. And wonderful to be here again.
Well, thank you.
And you're doing such a wonderful job on your show.
Well, that's very nice of you to say. If you were to describe yourself to somebody who didn't know you at all, what would you say?
First and foremost, I'm always a farmer, but I'm always looking to make farming better. So I'm always looking for creative ways to make it better, to find access to markets, for African-American farmers and other small farmers. But first and foremost, I'm a farmer. I love the land.
Did you ever think about doing anything else?
No. And, you know, the whole time I was going to school and my father's a farmer, just like you mentioned earlier. And I watched him farm. I watched both my grandfather's farm. My mother's father was a sharecropper. He died a sharecropper. And they taught me how to farm. And I said, hey, I'm going to be a farmer. I didn't grow up saying I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to be a lawyer. I wanted to be a dentist. I actually wanted to farm.
Do you remember why?
Always was excited about land ownership. So my father taught me very early on that land is the most important tool that a person can possess. And he taught me if I treat the land good, the land will take care of me. If you put down a proper lime seed and fertilize at the right time, that you can grow just as good a crop as any man. And that brought out the competitive edge in me, so I wanted to take what he was doing and turn it into something, bigger and better and more effective. And that's what I've been trying to do.
Hmm. Part of the reason that you began the National Black Farmers Association is that there were challenges that you were experiencing that, white farmers have not. And, intimately tied to that was the case, a long, long, long-running lawsuit that your group waged against the USDA and their lending practices, which was finally resolved after, how many years was that?
30 years. And basically, it was the government discriminating against black farmers for not lending them money on time, for not processing their loan applications. I always said farmers are faced with acts of nature such as hurricanes, tornadoes, and droughts. But you never should be faced with the actual hand of the federal government.
Let me ask you this, and it is a sensitive question. Why does it matter that black people farm?
Oh, I think it's a great part of history. I don't care how many generations you go back. You're only one or two generations away from somebody's farm. We all came from the farm. That's why we were brought to this country as black people. We were brought here to work the land and clean up the South for scotch-free as slaves.
Well, that's exactly why perhaps some people aren't interested in it.
Well, that's why it has a negative impact. And it's because of of the bad stigma that we had because of sharecropping, because of slavery. Our people, black people, die from everything. Heart attack, stroke, obesity. And it's from the foods that we're eating. If we had more black people growing healthy foods, we wouldn't have some of the illnesses that plague us. I would like to see our people go back to land ownership, get back to communities where we came from, and really start doing some positive things.
John Boy Jr. is president of the National Black Farmers Association. He's a fourth-generation farmer. John Boy Jr., thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
See, they load you up with words that have very little meaning when you start examining the words. Discrimination is one. Prejudice is another. Bigotry is another. They have a whole arsenal of words that when you start trying to use them, you start confusing yourself.
For some Americans, it's one of the worst things to have ever happened in this country. But for others, it's the very essence of progress. It is political correctness. And while it's been a flashpoint for decades, never before has it been at the center of a presidential campaign. At its heart, political correctness is a struggle over language, and as part of his Micropolis series, WNYC's Arun Venugopal turned to authors, playwrights, and linguists, people who think about, even obsess over words, to understand what this debate is really about.
The notion of political correctness has ignited controversy across the land.
In the spring of 1991, President George H.W. Bush took the stage at the University of Michigan and confronted what he saw as a new threat to the country, political correctness.
Throughout history, attempts to micromanage casual conversation have only incited distrust. They've invited people to look for an insult in every word, gesture, action. And in their own Orwellian way, crusades that demand correct behavior crush diversity in the name of diversity.
This was the moment, about 25 years ago, when political correctness leapt out of intellectual circles and into the national discourse. Conservatives had already seized upon the term, and headline writers were having a field day with it, conjuring the threat of the liberal thought police out to indoctrinate your children. Soon, Hollywood joined in. With movies, really bad movies like PCU, starring David Spade and Jeremy Piven.
It's a whole new ballgame on campus these days, and they call it PC.
PC?
Politically correct. And it's not just politics, it's everything. It's what you eat, it's what you wear, and it's what you say. And if you don't watch yourself, you can get in a buttload of trouble.
To much of America, PC had come to mean humorless, dogmatic, moralizing, a bunch of word nags trying to make you feel guilty and out of step. Everyone had their favorite PC-ism. He's not short, he's vertically challenged. But to its proponents, people who generally hate the term PC, language matters, especially in a diverse society. It can be used by members of the dominant group to subtly assert their power. Or alternately, it can help minorities, women, ethnic groups, people with disabilities, define themselves and their own experiences. Seems reasonable enough. So, how is it that 20-something years later, Donald Trump...
I am so tired of this politically correct crap.
And Ted Cruz...
And political correctness is killing people.
And Sarah Palin...
They've been wearing this political correctness kind of like a suicide vest.
And perhaps most thoughtfully, Ben Carson.
It muffles people. And at the same time, keeps people from discussing important issues while the fabric of their society is being changed.
How is it that a quarter of a century later, conservatives are still getting mileage from this issue?
They're able to tap into this very deep cultural vein that has always been there.
Gish Jen is the author of the books Who's Irish and Typical American. She says it's because there are competing forms of American speech, the inclusive kind that keeps evolving with the times, and another kind going back to frontier days that just gets to the point.
From the very beginning, when we decided, well, what does it mean to be an American? It was, we don't wear wigs like the English. We don't sit on that kind of furniture. We reject artifice, and we rejected it from the beginning. To this day, you know, a piece of American furniture is an honest piece of furniture. It's not ornamental.
No nonsense. The same with speech. As Trump himself might put it, just say what you mean. But there's another aspect to this, Jen says, and it has to do with how Americans now approach authority.
There was always someone to say, that's not the right fork to use. There was always someone to say, we just don't talk like that. Who would that person be now? And we are so individualistic, we feel that we should be able to talk back to anybody. So we talk back to that authority as well. Who are you to tell me?
Writer and linguist John McWhirter says that for all the scorn from Republicans, political correctness has succeeded at making everyone, not just liberals, watch their words.
Because that Republican sense of threat is genuine and has changed the way many Republicans not only act, but I think also think.
In other words, they comply, even as they complain. But it's not just old white conservative men. According to a poll by Fairleigh Dickinson University, two-thirds of all Americans think political correctness is a big problem facing this country. That includes solid majorities of Democrats, women, and people who aren't white. I myself live in a constant state of concern that I'll say the wrong thing, tweet the wrong tweet, affect the wrong jokey accent, and be outed forever as a racist, homophobic misogynist. McWhirter says that in order to understand why there's so much anxiety about these guidelines, about PC, it helps to understand the function of language.
Language is about having conversations. That's what it's designed for. If you can't say it, then it's as if you're being held back in terms of making your verbal footprint and also in exchanging that with other people. And that's what we're mentally built for. That's part of why solitary confinement drives people out of their minds.
McWhirter says the stakes are high.
Those who control language are controlling the self. When we control expression, we're controlling what sense of reality we create around us with our web of words.
And perhaps that's why this issue won't go away. Language is something we all share. It implicates us in ways that other forms of racial discourse don't. We can turn away from the videos of black men being shot, tune in and out of debates about criminal justice reform, poverty, segregation. But speech is inescapable, and policing it apparently works. In our perpetual discomfort and annoyance, we're forced to confront something we'd rather not. Playwright David Henry Wong says this confrontation is hardest for those who've traditionally benefited the most from American history.
I think there's a period we need to go through when the group that has had power has to understand that they have lost at least demographic power and then how to adjust to that. And in some sense in this country, because race has always been one of the big fault lines in this nation's history, in some sense, this country isn't going to begin to heal racially until white people think about race as much as everybody else does.
Wong does not expect this struggle over language and power to be resolved anytime soon. It's taken us centuries to get to this point. And he thinks that things will get worse before they get any better. This is Micropolis. I'm Arun Vanagopal at WNYC.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Damn you, Obama.
Allegheny County DA Stephen Zappala answering critics who say he let the suspects in a brutal beating at a T station off easy, and that includes the victim. This story has made national headlines, and Zappala now faces added scrutiny as he runs for Pennsylvania Attorney General. Channel 11's Rick Earle joins us live now with more of this interview that you'll see only on 11. Rick?
Yeah, Lisa, some community activists have criticized the decision that allows four of the five suspects in this beating case to avoid jail time. But today, in an exclusive interview in Philadelphia with the district attorney, he offered an explanation.
The good thing about this, it's on video. So the fact that you can see that, you can see exactly what happened, it doesn't have to be what you say it is, it doesn't have to be what I say it is. You see it on tape, it's objective.
Allegheny County District Attorney Stephen Zappala defending the decision to offer plea deals with no jail time. to four of the five white suspects charged in connection with the racially motivated attack of a black man at the Wood Street T station. Zapala says it's clear from the video that only one of the men was actually involved in the assault, and he says that man will face jail time.
And you can see from the video that one person actually assaults him, puts him on a track. Another guy is standing there and won't let him come up. The other three just kind of stand around.
Three of the defendants were charged with conspiracy to commit robbery, one with reckless endangerment. This week, those four pleaded guilty and were given probation and community service. That drew sharp criticism from the victim.
Five black guys jumped one white guy. Nobody will be going home.
But Zapala says Ryan Kyle, the defendant accused of the beating, faces a lengthy jail time after pleading guilty to aggravated assault and ethnic intimidation.
The guy that hurt him is going to go to a penitentiary. And that's the significance of that matter.
Now, the head of the Alliance for Police Accountability told me this afternoon that she believes all five cases should have gone to trial for a jury to decide. As for Ryan Kyle, he faces 3 to 6 years in prison when he's sentenced in May. That's the very latest reporting live tonight. Rick Earle, Channel 11 News.
See, it used to be we could beat up minorities and nobody cared. It's the reason a lot of us joined the force. Hey, Mitch, you want to go down and arrest some homeless people but not be able to beat up any minorities? No, thank you. Yeah, no, I think we're good.
Right now, a former Fort Lauderdale police officer is fighting to get his job back.
Yeah, he was fired last year over a racist video and then some text messages that he sent. Two other officers were also charged and they resigned. Local 10 News reporter Cheyenne Malone has more details in Fort Lauderdale.
No, it is a day two in this arbitration hearing as Jason Wells fights to get his job back. Now, there's been a lot of back and forth on both sides, but our cameras were there as one of the internal investigators on the case was questioned.
So basically, it created an issue within the department of officers. It created a racial divide, basically. Like I had never seen in our department. It was the knowledge based that there was a race case in internal affairs, and four officers were relieved of duty based on it.
Now, this video is an example of what investigators say caused that racial divide within the department. Jason Wells and four others investigated after racist text messages, pictures, and homemade video trailers showing other races, let's just say, in not so positive of a light.
Nigga!
Now, Wells, one of three of the officers fired after the videos were released. He's the first to go through this arbitration process, though. The fourth officer involved resigned on his own. Now, I am told Chief Adderley is set to testify in this case, as well as Wells, and our cameras will certainly be there and give you the latest information as we continue to follow the story. Reporting live in Fort Lauderdale, Cheyenne Malone, Local 10 News.
Plenty of people drive through the West Overton Village section here in East Huntingdon Township, where behind me on a fence, you'll find a Confederate flag with an African-American baby doll in a noose. Rachel Zolick was driving down Porter Road in Scottsdale Tuesday when she spotted this, a black baby doll in a noose in front of a Confederate flag.
We actually turned around because we had passed the house, and there it was. And you know, at first it was shock.
Shock quickly shifting to anger. Rachel posting the picture on her Facebook page where dozens commented and shared it.
It's not right. It's despicable.
The photo made its way to Pittsburgh's Action News 4. We called East Huntingdon Township's top supervisor, Paul Hodgkiss.
Definitely against anything like that in our township.
Hodgkiss says he found out about the flag and doll just Tuesday afternoon when a man who lives nearby called him. But officials in Scottsdale Borough said they've been hearing about it for months. However, it's outside their jurisdiction.
It probably is allowed to be there on his property, but if we can do anything to stop it, we will.
We saw the flag outside the home on Porter Avenue, but when we knocked on the door, no one answered. Then, when we drove by again about 5 minutes later, the flag, doll, and noose were all gone. Zolick says in the end, that's all she ever really hoped for.
I just hope he has to take it down. That's all I want. You know, I don't care. I don't want him punished. I just want him to take it down so that we don't have to look at it.
Township officials told us they had planned to meet tomorrow to discuss the situation, but now that the flag is down, it remains unclear what actions, if any, they will take. Reporting in East Huntingdon Township, Bo Berman, Pittsburgh's Action News 4.
Look away.
of using racial slurs and a pole with the Confederate flag to bash a car. As WDRB's Danielle Lama explains, the alleged incident involves students from Bullitt East High School. Danielle.
Adrian, Mount Washington police say this happened last Friday, and two students are now charged in connection to the investigation.
She was standing in the middle of the road, waving the rebel flag, calling her the N-word multiple times.
Nigger!
Tabitha Perkins says her 17-year-old biracial daughter is the victim and that she was once friends with the two students near Bullitt East High School outside Blevins' home. Investigators wouldn't say what led up to it. Perkins is calling the incident a hate crime.
Angry, upset, sad. Sad that we're still here. You know, this is 2016.
Police say the courts will decide if this is a hate crime, but Blevins' family is claiming it's all an elaborate story. Her stepdad told me this was not about race, just teenage girl drama. He says the truth will come out in court. Chapman's father declined to comment. The district is weighing in, though, saying there's no evidence of a hate crime. Their statement also said in part, school personnel have reacted with appropriate punishment and are providing one-on-one escort to the affected students while in school. The district also says the school employees have been monitoring these students and giving regular updates to the parents. Reporting live from the newsroom tonight, I'm Danielle Lama, WDRB News.
So how's the college responding to this incident?
We're having a race forum.
And what's that?
A forum on race, so we can discuss the incident and the surrounding issues of race.
So the usual lip service.
No comment.
We're going to talk about pretty serious subject this hour. Three former San Jose State University students are currently on trial. In fact, that trial, strangely enough, in terms of serendipity, is expected to end today while we're speaking here. But they're on trial for hate crimes that were committed against an African-American freshman back in 2013. This was a story that got national coverage. They were accused of repeated physical and mental abuse, including fastening a bike lock around the victim's neck. And as campuses across the nation struggle to respond to racist incidents, we want to discuss what the school has done to address racial issues in the wake of 2013 incident, which sparked widespread anger and protest. Let me tell you who is here with us. I want to welcome First Judge Doris Cordell, who is a former independent police auditor for the city of San Jose Special Task Force on Racial Discrimination. She chaired, a retired judge of the Superior Court of California. Judge Cordell, good to have you back with us.
Thank you.
Let me also welcome Bill Armeline, is Director of Human Rights Program and Associate Professor of Justice Studies at San Jose State University. Welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And Marcus Pizarro, who is here to my left, Professor and Chair of Mexican-American Studies at San Jose State, Faculty Coordinator of the Chicano Latino Student Success Task Force. He was also San Jose State's Special Task Force Chair on Racial Discrimination. Welcome to the program. And I'm pleased to say we have a couple of students with us as well. Gary Daniels is a student activist at San Jose State. He was one of the organizers of the protests around the 2013 hate crime incident. Welcome, Gary Daniels. And Janae Gray is also with us, another student, a member of the Black Student Union. Welcome. Glad to have you with us as well. Janae Gay, let me begin with you, and let's talk about, because your story is really, in many ways, a very compelling one. You came here from San Bernardino. You kind of lived in a somewhat protected community, mostly a white community. And one of the things that drew you to this university, to be a student at this university, was diversity and seeing that statue of the race fists and the like.
Yeah, so I came here in 2012 on an Avid college trip. We visited all the northern campuses, and I automatically chose San Jose State because I saw the John Carlos and Tommy Smith statues, the MLK library. It was representative to who I am, and something that we did on our Avid trips, me and my other friends, we would go around campus and we would count how many black people we saw throughout the whole tour. So, you know, we were fairly pleased. I suppose, I don't really remember, but I knew that the statues, and I was like, this is diversity. This is a city. Where I come from isn't really a representative area, and I faced a lot of adversities back home, so I want to get out of that atmosphere.
So here's all this hope and idealism, feeling of diversity, feeling maybe of being welcome, and then you're in a meeting with the Black Student Union, and suddenly you hear about what occurred. And you were, I think the way you described it was traumatic. You were traumatized.
Yeah, it's definitely a traumatic experience even today. I just came back from the last hearing for DJ, and just hearing the details, kind of being here today speaking about it is traumatic even for black students, me as a black student.
What is your response when you hear some of these comments about that? In fact, the defense lawyer for the young men who were charged with this talking about, I was just a prank that got carried away, and it was all meant in good fun, and it's been taken to an extreme, and now we've got a $5 million lawsuit and so forth. I mean, using that as a kind of cornerstone to their defense, really.
For me, saying that as a prank speaks more volumes than saying it wasn't. To think that locking, and even hearing the details today at the hearing, the explicit details, to lock him in his room, in his closet multiple times, barricading him, putting bike locks, putting swastikas, to think that's a joke, and putting white papers over everyone's doors but his, targeting him as a black male, and representing, putting the bike chain over his neck is representing a historical context of lynching. So to think that's a joke.
Plus the nicknames, Three-Fifths and Fraction, because of Three-Fifths of Man in the Constitution. You saw the Confederate flag, in fact, didn't you?
Yes. At the time, I lived in Campus Village B, and I saw the flag hanging from the CVC window. And I was kind of in disbelief, like, what was going on?
Do you still feel marginalized here more than, again, we go back to that moment where you felt this is a place for me, but I think you've said you've African-American students, and you've said this as a member of the Black Student Union, are marginalized on this campus. Yes. You feel marginalized.
Definitely there's still things that we are still fighting for. There's still things that we are requesting. Prior to the hate crime, we were still requesting an inclusive space, and not inclusive in a way that you guys have these resources, just use what everyone else uses, but to actually feel like we belong on campus and having unique resources that we feel like we need to thrive, because we are, most of us are non-traditional students.
Janae Gay, again, here with a student and member of the Black Student Union, and Judge Ladoris Cordell, also with us, who chaired the San Jose State Special Task Force on Racial Discrimination. And first thing I have to mention is Judge Cordell, you wrote an editorial about this trial that, as I said, it seems to be winding up today, and you talked about the wobbly effect. In other words, legally, you could go with a misdemeanor or you could go with a felony, and they went with a misdemeanor. This seemed to you to be wrong, plain and simple.
Right. Just as an aside, when the defense attorney talks about a prank, I mean, defense attorneys do what defense attorneys do, which is provide whatever defense you possibly can. To me, that seems almost an indefensible conduct. But that being said, yes, I did write an opinion piece that the district attorney had a decision to make. In the law, there are wobblers, meaning a particular criminal conduct, can be deemed either a felony or a misdemeanor. And the difference between the two is the punishment that can be imposed on each. The district attorney opted to file a misdemeanor for this conduct, and I was shaken by that, and I felt that that discretion was not aptly applied, and it should have been labeled felony conduct, because whatever we label it sends a message. And the message, there should have been, I think, a much stronger message sent throughout not just San Jose State, but
because
throughout
it's a hate crime.
That's correct, because it's hateful conduct.
The real question I have for you with this task force, which did some really yeoman type of work, I must say, is was this an aberration, or are we talking about something systemic? Because as we heard, there are many students who not only felt they were coming into a diverse and accepting environment in this campus, but there's been a massive study that says that students feel as if they're accepted here. There's like a 70% rate of kind of positive sense of acceptance and diversity on this campus.
Let me say that anything that has to do with race in this country, it's not an aberration. So when we talk about, for example, there are people who really want to believe in a post-racial America, there is no such thing, and there never will be in this country. What we should be fighting for is a post-racist America. So this commission, which you said correctly was open, it set the standard for how any university or college should look at incidents like this, because this task force was completely transparent. There was not one secret meeting. Everything was done in public.
Can I say this is thanks to you? Because it is thanks to you. I mean, you insisted on it.
I did insist upon it. And fortunately, the president of the university agreed with us that we would do this. So that's why this task force had credibility within the university setting. But the issue now is what has happened to the 52 recommendations that came out of this very transparent process. And bottom line is all of these recommendations will have impact depending upon the leadership of this university. It is leadership that sets the standard and will determine where this university goes on the issues of race.
Well, we have the acting president here with us of San Jose State, Sue Martin, but you've described your encounter with President Qaiomi, who is now in Afghanistan, like looking at a deer in the headlights?
Yeah, it was really, and it was sad. That when he interacted and he asked me to come and chair this, I mean, it was as if this entire incident and that the circumstances surrounding it were news to him, and that he was looked literally to me like, not literally, but he looked like a deer caught in the headlights, and that how did this just happen? So, and sadly, that's a reflection of leadership being out of touch with what was going on the campus. I don't mean to say that he was not well-intentioned. He was absolutely well-intentioned, but I think ill-informed about what was happening on this campus.
There seemed to be a fairly good response at first, but as things moved up the line, there was more blockage and more difficulty getting responses. How is the responsiveness now to the recommendations that you've set forward, and what do you expect in terms of, what would you like to see in terms of compliance or at least going along with those recommendations?
Well, this task force came up with 52 recommendations, all of which were doable in our lifetime. So I find no excuse or reason why they should not all have been implemented by now. One of our main ones was the creation of an office to deal with issues of diversity on this campus with someone to lead it. And to my knowledge, that has not yet been done. There, in my view, is no excuse. Be it turnover of leadership or not, there's no excuse. It's absolutely critical to having an environment on this campus that is one that is favorable to all on the campus. So I'm very concerned about that.
Get on a train, same thing. Where's the colored section? Don't you know, boy? Go to the last car. The last car is a half mile down the track. Go to the last car if you want to ride the train. You got 2 minutes to see if you can do a Jesse Owens down there. But we're leaving.
Wow.
You and your grandmother, too, and she's on crutches.
Wow.
She better learn how to run like Jesse.
Who was also a victim of white supremacy.
Absolutely. Hitler said that.
Mm.
Call him an animal. When wow. Jesse Owens ran around that track and beat everybody doing it, Hitler said, hey, that's not even in the rules. So you matching, you know, a person with an animal.
Wow.
Yeah, if you put a horse out there, I mean, you expect a horse to run faster, right? But a horse is a horse. And a nigger is the same as a horse. You know, you ride him and beat him. You know.
In studio, we've got the wonderful Lorenz Grant, in the studio, Lorenz.
Hello, how are you? And I'm in New York and jealous that you just had a mountain drive.
Let me just tell everybody a little bit about Lorenz and why she's in the studio. She's a wonderful filmmaker, but as many of you may or may not know, tomorrow will be the national debut of a film about Jesse Owens called Race. And it's been getting a lot of play. And actually, we're going to have an interview with the star of Race on in just a few minutes. Actually, Jamal saw the film, is going to tell you a little bit about it. But the reason we've got Lorenz in the studio is that she did a remarkable documentary called Jesse Owens. And if you have not seen it, you got to see it. Lorenz was a director and producer. And this was the first full-length documentary about Jesse Owens, who, of course, is the legendary legendary athlete. And, you know, and the film talks about the life and the legacy of Owens and, you know, how his 4 gold medals were won in the 36 Berlin Olympics and how he defied Hitler's Aryan ideals. And it was also about the frustration of coming back to the United States. And the film won an Emmy for Outstanding Research, and it won 2 Emmy nominations for Outstanding Historical Long Form and Outstanding Music and Sound. And it aired on PBS in the United States and Europe. So I don't know if we've had a chance to do anything professionally since then, but Lorenz, congratulations on just a great documentary. And before you say thank you, the latest documentary Lorenz produced was The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, and that actually premiered at Sundance, and it was your third film to premiere at Sundance, and it opened theatrically worldwide in the fall of last year, 2015, and it played a remarkable 8-week run at the Film Forum in New York City, and acknowledged as one of the top 5 documentaries of 2015 by the National Board of Review. And it's going to air a PBS Independent Lens film of, it actually did, right? February 16th, yesterday?
Yes.
Oh, man. So now, Lorenz, you could talk and you could accept the congratulations and tell us just how great you've got to feel.
Oh, this is fantastic. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the introduction, and I love your podcast, and it's really exciting to actually be a guest on your podcast.
Before we have our brief interview with Stefan James, Lorenz, just could you talk about, there's a film coming out, you know, obviously on Jesse Owens. What's the difference when you do the film versus the sort of documentary? What's been your experience on what viewers can suggest? Because, you know, they did the same thing with Jackie Robinson. And I think Ken Burns is going to do a documentary on Jackie Robinson. But what's usually the difference between the film version people are going to see and the actual documentary?
Well, this is really an exciting time because I would say there was a huge firewall, if you will, between documentaries and feature films. And how exciting that just within a couple of years of directing the documentary on Jesse Owens, there's now a feature film coming out. So I'm really thrilled for his family in particular, since, you know, they grew up with the legacy and, you know, they're always bombarded with requests. And it's, I'm sure, grateful them to see that these requests actually panned out into finished products that people are really speaking to and really enjoying. I think one of the toughest parts, certainly, of documentary filmmaking is, you know, we do in some way have shoulder the burden of the record, if you will, the responsibility of that record. And we are charged with, of course, telling the story, but also hoping we can find the rich, exciting archival materials, people who knew the subject, and hopefully to try and bring that subject and that person to life. With Jesse Owens, I mean, goodness, when I did it, it was a 75-year-old story. Now it's even older than that. So I didn't even know if I'd get anybody on camera who knew him. And in some ways, I had, you know, a half a dozen people who were actually survivors who saw Jesse Owens compete. They were children or teenagers at the time. as well as a few people who were team members who were actually on the 1936 Olympic team and traveled to the games together on the ship, both men and women. One of the more maybe poignant interviews of that is Louis Zamperini. You know, I got one of the last interviews of him before he died, and you know, right before his big movie came out, and he was just a wealth of information and actually loves telling that story because that was certainly one of his highlights. I mean, he went on to do, you know, of course, incredibly other things, but that's one thing we do as documentary filmmakers. We really try and, or at least I do, I like to try and put the viewer in the moment or in the time and in that person's mind. With a runner as a subject and a track runner, goodness, that was even more challenging because that person, you can almost say, it's a very intellectual and internal and in private battle that you're having. It's not a team sport. You know, you're not competing really necessarily against each other or using your teammates to kind of get through different important plays. I mean, it's really, you know, you against the wind, if you will, and against your competitors. So that was the biggest challenge to me, how to bring that internal struggle, that internal athletic prowess and internal genius to the screen and out so someone could see that. So how I tackled that was looking a lot at, certainly if I could find footage of him, I was lucky to stumble upon some training footage that I have in the documentary of him working with Coach Snyder, and where you actually see how he is Jesse Owens and how he worked on him. It was just, it is true perfection, you know, as you even commented in the documentary yourself, Bill. So it was really exciting to actually bring those real life elements and include them in the film, and then also maybe remind people or educate people of what was going on at that time. You know, one thing I didn't know was that there was even a boycott movement that could have, in fact, derailed the games or the U.S. participation in the games. And imagine if the U.S. team did not go. In an ironic way, there may not have been a Jesse Owens, because certainly the next Olympic Games was canceled due to World War II. So it was really interesting to look at those geopolitical events through this man, through this legend, but also hopefully look at him through a human being, through a black man in America, that what the stakes were just so high and how he actually managed to concentrate and come through those stakes that, you know, 100 years later, we're still talking about his legacy.
You know, Jamal, I want to hear, you know, because you actually saw the film, and I want to get your take on it. But I guess sort of to round out that point, Lorenz, I guess the difference between the documentary and the film is that, you know, the film you could show, you know, you could show, you know, footage and the things that Jesse Owens said. But I guess the filmmaker can now sort of fictionalize or what Jesse Owens felt about the boycott.
Right.
What he felt when the civil rights leaders approached him. And although there may not be footage of that, I guess the filmmaker who's doing sort of the fictionalized version can sort of, you know, invent things or piece together, you know, what they know about him to, you know, make him talk in a contemporary way. So maybe that's an advantage.
Yes, I would agree with that. And, you know, we could have the headlines, the news articles, or, you know, I had worked with parts of his diary. So you can have some of his language and how he spoke. But yes, the movie gives you that artistic license to actually have those conversations with his teammates, with anybody. You know, right. That just gives you that whole sort of dramatic and emotional landscape that you can expand upon in that narrative way. You know, in the documentary way, we're a little more, you could say, challenged or hindered by, okay, here's a news headline. Here's the footage of him talking in these five sentences.
Right.
Or, you know, and so, but then that's what's beautiful and exciting about now that these are both out, you can, as a viewer, kind of play one against the other and hopefully come out with even a richer, fuller image of him and that era.
Right. Yeah, the movie, I liked it. I thought, like you said, it's the movie is a dramatization of it, right? So, and it did a good job with that. It definitely hit an emotional chord. You know, I'm in the movie watching it, and you get a little emotional. You know, you're rooting for Jesse Owens. Stephon James did a great job acting as Jesse Owens. I felt like I was actually watching Owens perform and win and, you know, go through the trials and tribulations. So I think the movie did a pretty good job. Again, you know, like we said, it's entertainment. The movie is more entertainment than the documentary is more about bringing facts to the table, probably. But all in all, you know, I enjoyed the movie. And most importantly, I think that it was great timing for the movie to come out. Jesse Owens is someone I grew up hearing about. You know, I think I don't know if it was in history books or not, but I feel like I learned about Jesse Owens in elementary school, you know, and, you know, heard his story. But, you know, in the last 10, 20 years, it's not someone who's brought up that much. And you kind of, I never forgot about him, but I feel like his story has kind of been forgotten, you know, as we move on, as more and more sports athletes are becoming famous. So I think it was perfect timing for the millennials, for the younger generation to have, you know, to see this story again about Jesse Owens, who, you know, one of the all-time, or if not the most important, definitely black athlete of all time because of what he did, in 1936, was it? The 1936 yeah. Olympics in Germany in front of Hitler that changed the life of all black people and all Americans, period.
You know, what I liked about what you did in the documentary, Lorenz, was, and I think they did it in the real life film too, was just show the what America was like, I think, in 36, and, you know, with the lynchings, and even when Jesse Owens came back, it was one thing, you know, and that's sort of the ongoing hypocrisy of a democracy built on slavery. Was showing the America that he came back into, and both do that, but I mean yours did it in a very raw way. Also, you know, one of the things that this film did, Lorenz, is that they sort of talked more about Snyder, the coach. And in fact, maybe if I had an issue, it was, you know, I guess sort of my paranoia, you know, always trying to make the white guy the hero, you know, of a black story, you know, like somehow, you know, do a documentary of Elijah, of Muhammad Ali, and, you know, make Angelo Dundee the hero, you know. But in this story, they did focus a lot on Snyder, right, Jamal? I mean, they made Snyder more or less, you know, a co-hero.
Correct.
Of the Jesse Owens story. And I guess, what was your take on Snyder's role, or when you were going through the footage and determine how to assemble the film?
Yeah, that may be another potential difference with the Hollywood films, you know, the quote-unquote packaging, you know, the art of the package. How do you get your film financed? You know, maybe they had to spend, you know, additional time. Like, of course, you know, athlete is shaped, mentored, et cetera, by their coach. But when I was, as a director of the documentary, you know, I'm casting as well. And to me, Jesse Owens is the center of the story. And the other people are there if they, you know, provided insight or help. Of course, I'm giving them their nod, but I'm not going to wander off topic and lose focus on the end game of the subject and of the film. So maybe that's, you know, another element that Hollywood is either, you know, hindered by, or maybe it helps by, however you want to look at that, because I bet you that packaging has a lot to do with it. Who's going to be in the film? Who's going to see the film? Is it going to be diverse enough that you're going to get enough of these audiences? Because they're really looking at the bottom line.
You know,
they're really crunching numbers in a way that a documentary isn't necessarily, you know. We have the benefit of what they call the long tail, if you will. You know, people can still, if people are still downloading Jesse Owens on iTunes or talking about it, then that adds, and that's included in its success. You know, it's not just sink or swim the first time of the weekend or the first night of the broadcast, because that's just such a huge burden that documentaries can't really bear. Although the marketplace is changing and we're now, you know, thrown into that as well. But I think that could be, you know, maybe one slight difference. You know, I don't know. I didn't work on the film. I'm just speculating. But that could be one difference. And also, I think that's also part of filmmaking, the point of view. You know, I believe that is very central and important. And that's probably why the larger conversation of who is making films and who is allowed to make films and who Right. gets funding to make films Right. is so contentious, because in the end, what you are seeing is shaped by the director.
Yeah, you know, and again, that's why I love your work. I love Stanley's work because I trust you. You know, as an African American, I trust you. I trust you to tell the story, not to whether it's for ideological reasons or the bottom line. You don't make people the hero who aren't supposed to be the hero. You know,
right.
To throw bouquets to white supremacy or something like that. I mean, that's a strong language, mm-hmm. but. We've seen that so often. You could have easily done that with any number of films you've worked on. You know, you could have, you know, not just given a nod to good people who have helped mm-hmm. and good white people who have helped, but made them the heroes, mm-hmm. where the heroes were really those men and women who gave their lives, mm-hmm. you know, and had their lives taken, by the way.
White people got more in common with colored people than they do with rich people. We just got to eliminate them.
Eliminate?
Eliminate.
Who, rich people?
White people. Damn.
Black people, too. Brown people, yellow people. Get rid of them all.
All we need is a voluntary, free-spirited, open-ended program of procreative racial deconstruction.
Everybody just got to keep fucking everybody till they're all the same color.
Here in the United States, as many as 17 million people are born multiracial, born into families with two or more racial or ethnic backgrounds. Multiracial marriages and births are on the rise, and nowhere is this more evident than in Los Angeles. As Southern California Public Radio's Leslie Beristain Rojas reports, answering the "what are you" question still isn't easy.
It's the question that multiracial Americans hear all too often. So, what are you?
It's a really complex question.
I go back and forth. I'll say I'm black and Mexican, or I'll say Blaxican.
I say I am a culturally mixed woman searching for racial answers.
I asked several Angelinas what they say when someone asks them about their background, because it's a question that more Americans are getting. The U.S. is becoming increasingly mixed. The U.S. Census counted 9 million people who described themselves as multiracial in 2010. But last year, the Pew Research Center estimated the number is almost twice that. Here's why. Researchers asked questions about people's family history and found that many who identified as one race in fact had a parent or grandparent of another race. That's because multiracial identity is fluid. Take Fanshen Cox. She's a Los Angeles actor and playwright. Her father is a Jamaican immigrant. Her mother is Native American and Danish. She says one's identity can depend on where you were raised, your family dynamics, and how the rest of the world sees you.
In D.C., which is where I was born, I was red bone and high yellow.
These terms labeled her as a light-skinned black person and set her at a distance. Cox has turned her experience with race and identity into a one-woman play that she performs around the country. But her racial identity has always been in flux, like when her family moved to Massachusetts.
So in Cambridge, I'm other. And then I learned mulatto. And I'm like, oh, okay, I'll try that on for a little while. Biracial was very popular there.
Then she went to college. For the first time, Cox says she felt accepted by fellow black students as one of them.
I grew the relaxer out of my hair, started listening to a lot of Public Enemy and snapping my gum, rolling my eyes at all white people. You know, I performed. I performed race.
But it all came to a screeching halt when she joined the Peace Corps and moved to West Africa.
And the minute I get to West Africa and tell everybody, hey, brothers and sisters, I'm black, they're like, no, 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 you're not. You're white.
For Walter Thompson Hernandez, the what are you question has all kinds of answers.
Depending on where I am in Los Angeles, where I am in the U.S., and also where I am in the world.
That's because he was raised by his Mexican-American mother in Huntington Park, a neighborhood that's 97% Latino. But his father is black.
I saw myself as Mexican, but, you know, I stood out. I was always the, like, tallest kid. I was always, you know, had the curliest hair, the darkest skin.
In his early 20s, he reconnected with his dad. It was around that time that he first heard the term Blaxican for black and Mexican. It resonated, and he ran with it. 2 years ago, as a graduate student, he began documenting the lives of fellow Blaxicans, collecting people's stories and sharing their photos on Instagram. He says the project has helped him make sense of who he is and the two worlds that he moves between.
In Mexican spaces, you know, I sort of can adapt how I speak, and I can sound very Chicano or Mexican, But, you know, in say, African-American circles or spaces, you know, I can also code-switch as well. So I think that's what being multiracial sort of embodies, you know, being able to exist in different worlds.
Lots of different worlds. More children are being born to multiracial couples. Some of them can move between three or more racial identities. Like in Sonia Smith Kang's family, she's Mexican-American and Black. Her husband is Korean-American. Together, they're raising their kids as all of the above.
They definitely identify the Black, the Korean, and Latina, and mixed. So it's almost like you have a fourth, an extra.
That idea, the all-of-the-above identity, is what inspired Smith Kang to launch a children's clothing line. She calls it mixed-up clothing. Think shirts printed with Mexican Dia de los Muertos designs or dresses made from African fabrics. She sees the clothes as icebreakers, a way to get people talking about their own cultural and racial identity, however they describe themselves.
I think that's one of the cool things about identity. It's mine, and I'm able to self-identify. And it's not me trying to convince you who I am. It's who I am.
In other words, you can check any and all boxes that apply. Covering emergent communities, I'm Leslie Beristein Rojas.
My skin is black. My forehead low. My hair is woolly too. My back is strong. Strong enough to carry on after genocide and all my family gone.
There is a statue in South Carolina honoring a man who is known as the father of modern gynecology. The inscription on the statue reads, "The first surgeon of the ages in ministry to women, treating alike empress and slave."
J. Marion Sims was a physician who was born in South Carolina in 1813.
This is Vanessa Northington Gamble. She's a physician and medical historian at the George Washington University. We asked her to come in to tell us the story of J. Marion Sims, who is memorialized in statues not only in South Carolina, but also in Montgomery, Alabama, and Central Park in New York City.
He started a clinic in Montgomery, Alabama. And at the time, in order to survive financially, he also was a plantation physician, where he took care of the enslaved on plantations.
This is where the story of Sims becomes complicated. Because yes, the inscription on a statue in South Carolina is true. He did invent techniques that help women to this day. He treated slaves as well as high society. He once treated Empress Eugenie, the last Empress of France. But there is something not mentioned on the inscriptions on the statues.
Starting in 1845, he started to conduct experiments on enslaved women. And why we talk about Sims today and why that statue was there is that he perfected a technique to repair a condition called vesico-vaginal fistula. And let me tell you what that means. It basically means that there is an opening between the vagina and also the bladder, or the vagina and the rectum, which usually comes after traumatic childbirth. And Sims started in 1845, 1846, according to some sources, a series of experiments to repair these fistulas.
This condition was highly stigmatized and dangerous for these women. There was no treatment. So on the one hand, you could say Sims was doing what doctors are supposed to do by taking these women on as patients. But there's another side to what Sims did. He wanted to be a trailblazing researcher. And these women, their bodies, became props in his journey of scientific discovery.
These women were property. These women could not consent. These women also had value to the slaveholders for production and reproduction, how much work they could do in the fields, how many enslaved children they could produce. And by having these fistulas, they could not continue with childbirth and also have difficulty working.
There are 10 slave women central to the story. 3 are named by Sims in his writing. These women were brought to him by their owners. The first woman was named Anarcha.
Anarcha was a 17-year-old enslaved woman who had just undergone a very traumatic delivery. Some sources say that she was in labor for 3 days. At first, he did not want to treat her. He was not interested in treating women. But then what he started to do from a period from 1845 to 1849, he did a series of experimental surgeries on these women. And he uses sutures to try to close up this opening.
Now, presumably this would have been painful.
It was very painful. And he talks about how Lucy, one of the three women, almost felt as if she were going to die, that she cried out in pain so much because of these surgeries. But at the same time, he writes that the women wanted the surgery because they did not want to have the condition anymore.
Were the surgeries that he was performing on them performed without anesthesia?
They were performed without anesthesia. There was a belief at the time that Black people did not feel pain in the same way. They were not vulnerable to pain, especially Black women, so that they had suffered pain in other parts of their lives, and their pain was ignored.
As Sims's reputation as a researcher grew, he began to invite other physicians to come watch as he performed the surgeries.
So this surgery was done where Black women were naked. So when we think about it, I think we think about pain. We also need to think about how these women's dignity were also taken away from them.
For a long time, the surgeries didn't work.
No, he's not successful at the beginning. And so that's why these surgeries went on from 1846 to 1849. And finally, after 30 surgeries on one woman, he was finally able to perfect his technique.
That woman was Anarcha. The two others who are named in Sims's papers are Betsy and Lucy. I asked Vanessa Gamble whether there was any way to know if these women actually wanted the surgeries.
We do not know that. The only thing we know is that Sims said that these women, one of the women, clamorously wanted to have the surgery. They wanted to be cured. One of the things in the story that's missing are the words and voices of the women themselves, not being translated by Sims.
Sims, of course, has a self-interested reason to say that the women wanted what he was trying to do to them.
Of course he has an interest. And one of the interests is that it mutes the story of slavery in his work. That it mutes the story that the foundations of modern gynecology are based on the body and the pain of enslaved Black women.
The statue in South Carolina that says that Sims treated empress and slave women alike.
Yes.
Is that true? Was he treating white women the same way?
He did treat white women, but he treated white women with anesthesia. Sims left in the 1850s. He left Alabama and moved to New York City for health reasons. And he started a women's hospital in 1855 there. He gained a reputation as an excellent surgeon. And so that he did treat white women. But the technique had been perfected on the bodies of Black women.
When you hear about a story that took place 150 years ago, there is a part of us that says, that was pretty awful, mm-hmm. but that was then, and this is now. Mm-hmm. But a lot of your work has actually tried to broaden that idea and said, yes, that was then, but some of what was then is also with us now.
Right. I mean, one of the things that I teach a course on the history of race and racism in American medicine. And one of the things that I try to get across to my students is that racism is a very flexible, very adaptive concept. That, yes, Black people are not thrown out of hospitals these days because they are Black, or not excluded from hospitals because they are Black. But our focus today is on what happens once one gets into the hospital.
It's striking as you say this because I feel like I've read studies in the last few years looking at disparities in how people of color get treated for pain in the late 20th century and the early 21st century. It feels like there is a thread between what happened 150 years ago and what's happening today.
Right. I agree with you. I mean, because I think part of the story has to deal with how Black bodies are conceptualized by the medical profession. There is a video that Johns Hopkins put out about people with sickle cell disease. And in this video, this woman says, when I go to the hospital, even though I'm in pain, I make sure I get dressed up. Because if I get dressed up, maybe I will be treated better and not be seen as somebody who is seeking drugs. So it still is there in terms of how the medical profession views Black people and Black bodies.
It is true, though, that some of the things that Marion Sims discovered are still being used or inform medical practice today.
Yes.
He went on to become president of the American Medical Association.
Exactly. He was a member of the New York Academy of Medicine.
So this is a very conflicted legacy because presumably some of the things that he helped start or he helped invent are things that are of use to us today and we value and we benefit from that knowledge. Mm-hmm. And yet that knowledge was obtained at such great cost.
It was obtained at great cost. And I recently read a 2011 study that was done by physicians. And they looked at medical textbooks to see how Sims was referred. He was referred as a father of modern gynecology, someone who perfected the surgical technique, but no discussion about his legacy in terms of conducting these experimental surgeries on enslaved women. So that's part of the problem. We can say that some of these surgeries that he did, women today are benefiting from, especially in poor countries. But at the same time, we can't forget how that came to be.
I'm wondering, as someone who is a physician herself, what do you think should be done with those statues?
You know, it's one of those things where I'm conflicted. If you had asked me this question last spring, I would have given you a different answer. And I'll tell you why I'm conflicted. Last summer, I went to Liverpool. And Liverpool has a remarkable international museum of slavery. And one of the things that I did when I was in Liverpool, I took a slavery history tour because Liverpool was at the center of the transatlantic slave trade. And on an Art Deco building, there was an image of Neptune, since it's Liverpool and water. And underneath Neptune, there were two Black children who were in chains. And the tour guide, who was an 80-plus-year-old
black gentleman, asked us, do you think this should be taken down? And most people said yes. And he says, I think it should stay. And he said, I think it should stay because I don't want people to forget it happened. And so I think that we need to do something to commemorate the women, to add something to say, yes, Sims did this, but what about Annika? What about Lucy? What about Betsy? I think if we don't do that, that people will forget what happened to those women. So as a historian and as a teacher, I think that it's important for people to know what happened to those women. And if we whisk away these images of Sims, people will forget.
How do you hear what these women were going through? So if you could speak to Annika and Lucy and Betsy, what do you think they would tell you?
I think the story they would tell me would not start with Sims. I think the story they would tell me would be about their lives as enslaved women. It would begin there. It would begin how there were times where if that baby had survived, that the baby would have been taken away from them. They would talk to me about how, as being black women, their bodies were used sexually, that they did not have consent, and that what happened to them with Sims was part and parcel of what their lives were at that particular time. But I think the other thing they would want us to know is that they were human beings and that they also deserve their story to be memorialized, that we have statues of Sims in Columbia, South Carolina, in New York City. There are portraits in medical schools of Sims. Where is their story?
If you could build a memorial to Annika, Betsy, and Lucy, or a memorial that stood alongside the memorials that we have erected to Marion Sims in South Carolina and New York City, what would the memorial say?
The statue would not be of the experiments, because I think that it's important not just to think of them as victims of these experiments. It might be with the three of them together, or it might be with their holding children, that they were mothers, that they were women. So that's what would be part of it. So it would not be their prostrate on the altar of science. I think what the inscription would say is Betsy, Annika, and Lucy, the mothers of modern gynecology.
Professor Vanessa Northington Gamble is a physician and medical historian at the George Washington University.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, February 20th, 2016. So I have been told. Compensatory call-in. Feel free to chime in, share thoughts. The number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. quick commentary before we get to some of the folks who dialed in. If y'all have any feedback, things that you would like to share. First of all, we are fundraising for 2016. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. When you hit the blog, you'll see the PayPal button in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Again, huge thanks to all the folks who have invested over the years. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. That's it. Quick notes, things that stood out. The final clip that you heard, man, oh, man, I can only say once again, either you have victims of racism or you do not have victims of racism, white supremacy. That's one of the things that has come up pretty often on this here program about, you know, not calling black people victims. I'm not a victim. We shouldn't be referred to as victims. I think in the context, the black speaker in that segment, I think she was saying that she would not want some sort of memorial or statue to just focus on these black females as victims. But, you know, I come from the opinion what we need is truth, accuracy, honesty. Man, particularly this week, I wasn't able to see the entire film, but I was able to see segments from the Hunting Ground, the documentary that came out in 2015 about mostly white women being victims of sexual assault on college campuses and how this is not adequately being addressed. I am of the opinion they had no problem coming on camera to whimper and whine and cry. We're so mistreated. This is horrible. What's happening to us? This is dastardly. Wah, wah, wah. All of that, they had no problem coming out to say that they were victims. I take the position that we as black people, victims of white supremacy, that we should just be blatant about that. That's what it is. We are victims. Just to be accurate, to be truthful about that. And the terrorists, white people, just to make that very clear. I think that kind of lets them off the hook in not presenting that racism, white supremacy is a monumental crime and should be viewed as such constantly. And that crime has victims. Those victims are black people. I'll never forget. It was some years, I think, when the Cows first started out, our anniversary being tomorrow, but when we first started out way, way, way back in 2007. I called an enforcement official here in Seattle, and we were talking about, it was a case that made the news where one of the white fraternities, they were making racist comments and throwing items at a non-white person. I think it was so-called Asian students, but they were throwing items from the balcony at them and, you know, standard operating procedure. And I called him, and he said that we couldn't do anything. I was talking to the enforcement official. I was just trying to get more information about what happened because the police were called. And he said, we can't do anything if the person doesn't stay. It's, you know, we can't do anything. If we don't have a victim, there's no crime. That was the logic that they gave. If there's no victim, there's no crime. So it's not anything we can do. They shouldn't have left the scene. And, you know, that's all we can do. It's, you know, they should have stayed. Anyway, I'm very much of the opinion, let's just be accurate. We have victims of racism. I am one. Moving forward. That same story about Marion J. Sims, we've talked about him on the program before regularly. I think Dr. Niana Rasayan spoke about him a couple years back when he was on the program, not his most recent visit, but when he was on a previous program. We had, I believe it was Vernelia Randall, a black female. She was on the program some years ago, talked about him. His name has come up repeatedly. I wrote about him last year. The thing that came to my mind most immediately was that when I wrote about Dylan Storm Roof last year, and we talked about those statues and the Confederate flag and how they were saying we need to get rid of this, you know, hateful imagery and these hateful symbols. We need to take this flag down. We need to take this down and that down. I said, nobody mentioned J. Marion Sims, Marion J. Sims, excuse me. Nobody mentioned him. And, you know, we need to take that statue down. I didn't hear anybody say anything about that at all. I've said consistently, we are swimming in an entire environment of racism, white supremacy. Forgive the metaphor, but I mean, the environment is saturated. These monuments and symbols are all over the place. I don't even know how you would begin to take all of this stuff down. And as they said in the piece, we've said this before, that they have statues and monuments to this guy in New York and Alabama and South Carolina. I don't think they took any of that stuff down after the massacre at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina. At any rate, I thought that was important for many reasons. They didn't take Ben Tillman's statue down. They didn't take Mr. Sims' statue down or many of the other monuments to terrorists. I also thought it was significant in that piece, the way that they talked about him, which is consistent. They just don't use accurate terms. This guy was a terrorist. This guy was a white terrorist and a torturer. And we just don't use, I say that all the time, we just don't use accurate terms when we're talking about these people to try to pussyfoot it and, you know, go around and say, well, oh, you know, it's complicated. It's nuances. They try to throw out all this jargon to protect racists, where this guy is still revered. He's wonderful. He's great. You know, he did all of these great things. And, you know, maybe, you know, a few niggers were mistreated along the way. But I mean, hey, he did all these great interventions and we should laud him and recognize him for that. That is just racism, white supremacy in action. There's no way if Nat Turner, if he had invented something, if, you know, he was a great scientist or whatever, there's no way that he would be lauded and they would have, you know, whatever scientific accomplishment he achieved, that that would be primary when you talk about him. And then, you know, oh, yeah, by the way, he may have killed, you know, he may have killed one or two white people along the way. But, you know, that's secondary to all of his accounts. That is total nonsense. They will only do that sort of thing when they're practicing white supremacy. At any rate, next thing related in that same piece where they were talking about the statues in Liverpool, where they have these images of blacks, because this was a dominant part of the enslavement, what they call the Atlantic slave trade. That is so fascinating, and I think I've talked before on the program about the timing of the cows, where I just found, and I mean literally just started reading and getting information about Liverpool and how involved they were with slavery. I said, I think Friday, I said the book, our guest who's coming on the broadcast this Sunday, James Waveland, he has a book. It's called The Zong, Z-O-N-G. It's about a slave ship where they killed. It's hard to even get an accurate number, right? But the number approximately is around 150 black people were deliberately killed on this slave ship because they allegedly ran out of water. They didn't have enough for everybody. So, you know, of course, let's kill the niggers, get rid of them. But they talk about it because Liverpool is where the white people that owned the slave ship, the Zong, that's where they were operating from. And they ended up having a big trial about this, not for murder, but the trial was, hey, we had to kill 150 of these niggers on this ship for whatever reason. And we want our insurance. We want to be compensated for this. We have insurance on our slave ship. We want to be compensated for the loss of our niggers. And they go to trial, and of course they won. And the whites that owned the slave ship, they got compensated. But this has all happened in Liverpool, and they talk about how they have some of these statues in Liverpool. You can see them to this day. It was just fascinating for me that that popped up right at the time that I'm reading about this. The white man, the author of this book, he'll be on the program Monday. It'll be Monday early program because of the time difference. He'll be with us. If I got my math correct, it would be 1 p.m. Eastern. And that's 10 a.m. Pacific for folks, if you can ride with us early. But we'll be here Monday. Looking forward to having, always love having white people on the program, particularly when we can have white people on the program who are in different spots around the globe. And even connection, I think people had posted articles on my Facebook page where in Liverpool, Mario Balotelli, we've talked about him a lot, soccer player, black soccer player. He played for Italy, I believe, in the World Cup back in 2012. Lots of incidents with racism where he's being abused by white fans and what have you across the Atlantic, where white people were just harassing and terrorizing him during a soccer game again. Most recently, this happened the past week, but this was in Liverpool, and I just said, wow, the timing could not be better. Moving forward, the whole situation I think people saw with Killer Mike, he's an entertainer. He's been talking about racism, white supremacy quite a bit over the last couple years or such. I feel like I've seen him a lot ever since things broke with Michael Brown Jr. in 2014. But there was a lot of controversy this week because he made statements where he was talking about his support for Bernie Sanders, which he's been talking about for at least a month or so now. I've heard him, you know, talking about why he supports Bernie Sanders. But he quoted Jane Elliott, who's been a guest on our program repeatedly. Jane Elliott admitted racist in all the commentary that I've seen around this. They have referenced her as an anti-racist activist and a female advocate and all this other stuff. Nobody has said, oh, yeah, this is an admitted racist, Jane Elliott. But I'm paraphrasing the quote I think that he said from her was that he spoke with her and she told him that just having a uterus does not qualify you to be president. I think that was the quote that was given. And people were fussing at him and saying, oh, my gosh, that's such a, you know, a sexist comment. How could you say such a thing? And that's terrible. I can't believe he said that. I checked online. I might have missed it. Maybe I didn't do my due diligence, but I checked online. I did not see a single report, article, anything where somebody says, hey, let's get Jane Elliott. You know, I'm Jane. I'm an admitted racist. I'm a white woman. I've made money for decades. He's been doing this. I've made money and traveled all over the world talking about racism and being well paid to do so. Let me step out front. Anybody has anything to say about Killer Mike and what I said, you can address it to me. I made the statement. If you don't like what I said, if you have a problem with what I said, don't go fussing at this nigra. Take it up with me. I'm right here. If you got any questions, if you got any problems, I'm right here. I didn't see any of that. That's the sort of thing that I would expect from a white person who says, you know, I am allegedly working against racism or I'm trying to do something about this problem. That's what I would expect, not to see a black person being attacked verbally about something where they're quoting what you said. You talk, if she did have this conversation, I take it this was private, this wasn't a public thing, but if this conversation did happen, step up front, hey, I said it, and I will take any criticisms, any questions, if there's a need for clarification, or if anybody has a problem, doesn't like what I said, I'm right here, take it up with Jane Elliott in person. I didn't see any of that, and in my view, that's just another act of racism, white supremacy. And I would also say this is not a critique of Killer Mike. For me, it is just, I just don't think that we have an accurate understanding of racism, what it is, how it works, what it means to be white, whether it's Jane Elliott, whether it's Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump. You can just line up all the white people that you want on ad infinitum. We just do not understand where we think some of these white people are our pals, are our friends. Maybe they're going to do something at the beginning and end of the day. If they're white, we should be thinking this person is a racist, and I'm going to conduct myself as such. Whatever nice things they have to say, if they're talking about racism, if they're talking about trying to do something that's helpful for black people, at the end of the day, if this person is white, I suspect that they're racist. Maybe I still am going to vote for them, but I still think that this person is a racist. That is the logical way we should be thinking. I could be in error. But to me, that makes total sense if indeed there is a system of white supremacy. Again, no criticism of Killer Mike. Last thing I wanted to get in, the clip that I played on Jesse Owens, there were a bevy because the movie came out this week, so I could have picked a lot. That was Bill Roden. I think people are familiar with the book, William Roden. I think people are familiar with the book that he wrote, $40 Million Slave, came out some years ago talking about white supremacy in sports. Where he was talking with the black female filmmaker. She also worked on the Black Panther Project that aired on PBS this week, what have you. I thought it was interesting within that segment where they were talking about how the movie that came out this week on Jesse Owens, how it plays up his white trainer. And I've seen other people make that critique of the film as well, like they thought this was an act of racism where we got to big up this white guy who is not supposed to be the focus of the film. I thought it was interesting when Mr. William Roden talked about that, and he said he used the metaphor throwing a bouquet to white supremacy, and he said, "Ooh, that's harsh language." And then they continue with the dialogue. I thought it was totally accurate because they do this sort of thing all the time. People have talked about how they did that in 42, the story about Jackie Robinson, how this, you know, ends up happening on a regular basis, where it's something that's supposed to be focusing on black people, where they end up drifting off and, oh, yes, we have all these wonderful, great, grand white people. Look, see, like Jane Elliott. Look, see, look over here, see. And John Brown, isn't he great? See. Great. But that just stood out to me where he, in my view, was telling it like it is, but said, wow, that is kind of strong language indeed. We want accurate language. With that, we'll hit the phone lines. The number again, 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-POUND. If you could share one time and then allow everybody else, if they have questions or commentary, to get their comments in, that would be great. If you could watch how long you're speaking just to make sure everyone can share, that would be great. And if you could watch the background noise, super helpful. No metaphors for the Saturday program, please. Again, I just think that frequently victims of racism, we use metaphors to articulate racism, white supremacy, and frequently we're comparing things that are not accurate. I think we should all strive to be able to use accurate terms and to just be explicit, clear, make it plain when we're talking about racism, white supremacy, without having to consistently rely on a lot of analogies and metaphors and comparisons that frequently are not accurate and frequently are just not producing clarity with regards to what we're trying to say. Really appreciate that. No metaphors for the Saturday compensatory call-in. The first chunk of people who dialed in with a hand up, your lines are open, and I'll just kind of move in segments to get everybody. So the first, six people that dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Gus, for the program today. Good evening to everyone here today. I am still learning. I have concluded that black people problems are white people. White people lie to black people in all areas of people activity. White people are serious about being serious about practicing racism, white supremacy. Gus, thank you for having Dr. Frances Cress Wilson's sister, Lauren Cress Love, on the program on Tuesday, February the 16th, 2016. I was able to feel the soul of Dr. Frances Cress Wilson once again through her sister, Miss Love. Thank you, Gus, for that. I suspected Dr. Frances Cress Wilson's death was from a deliberate act of racism, white supremacy. After hearing Dr. Wilson's sister on the program, I determined that Dr. Wilson's death was from a deliberate act of racism, white supremacy. I miss having Dr. Wilson here with us more than I can find the words to say. I miss having Dr. Wilson here with us more than I can express. The most terrorized people on the planet are black people, more specifically the black male. Dr. Wilson's work made racism, white supremacy evidently clear to me. The racial identity confusion is epidemic here in Los Angeles by people of color. The people who classify themselves as white are not confused, and they are very serious to subject black people and people of color to racism, white supremacy. Black people, we have a lot of work to do to replace racism, white supremacy with justice. Dr. Wilson left us with detailed instructions. Let's get to work. No further comment.
Ashe, let's get to work. Other folks have comments that we haven't heard from. Feel free to share.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hey, Gus. Greetings, everyone that is listening. This is Puff. Listening to the comments on the on this broadcast, like before you started opening up the phone lines, I just wanted to bring out like a point. That a pattern in white supremacy, and that is extensive testing. Okay, just like just like the lady was saying with the statue of Dr. Sims, Marion Sims. Okay, he experimented on, and that's not a fact they choose to, quote-unquote, mainstream publicize, that he experimented on slaves. But, you know what I'm saying? In other words, to make him look like the white savior, quote-unquote, they don't publicize that fact that he operated on slaves and black women and see, they keep the data that he learned, which is a surgical technique. Just like, I just wanted to draw that correlation. It's a pattern that they experiment. In all their experiments, they keep data. And this is what keep white supremacy strong. Okay, just like the Jews in the Holocaust, they know what, they collect data with them too. Like, they'll know, like, I forgot what, like, test those were, but they have all that data, like how long a person can go without food, how long, like how long it'll take for you to freeze to death and all that type of stuff. All that data they got, like what'll happen if, that's what I'm saying, they collect data with everything they do. And just like in the school system, collecting data and exploiting it no matter what the cost. Like they won't tell that part, but they'll show the result, but they don't show how they got it, is what I'm saying. And that's a pattern in like white supremacy. Like, and they collect data with everything, like the school system. Like, they'll have, like, their school systems all have books. And you notice on the white, white people don't want Common Core. But in the black school system here, they have Common Core. And the schools don't even have books. And they do them little experiments and stuff. And they know what the test score is going to be and all that type of stuff. And if the score is higher, then those teachers would be available to hire in their school system. But they keep running the tests every time, is what I'm saying. So the bottom line of what I'm saying is collecting data, testing, is making sure that they program works. And that's a part of white supremacy. That's all I want to say. Go ahead.
For sure.
Happy hurt.
Yes, sir. If you could speak up a tad, Thomas in New York, that would be helpful.
No problem. Do you hear me better now?
Yes, that is better. Oh, before you get to your comments, the professor that you wanted us to get on the program, he replied, and he said he's willing to speak with us. The proposal that he made was that he can come on the program later next week. He said he could either do it a week from tomorrow, or he could do it during one of his classes. Now, I paused because I don't know the demographics of his class. If he has mostly non-white students, if it's white students.
Oh, well, I just know that my wife was in his class, and this was at Hostos, you know, Community College here. It's right over, it's right in the Bronx. Mm. So the demographics reflects the Bronx. You know, I say probably about, you know, 40% black, 40% Latino, and a few whites maybe. And he also teaches at John Jay University, which I would assume would have a much higher white concentration. So I don't know which one he'll be at. Hmm. And I know my wife doesn't go take his class anymore. She finished his class last year.
Okay. Well, I was just waiting to get a bit more information. I didn't want to ask him directly if he has mostly white students.
Yeah, well, if it's at Hostos, we're looking at a probably 80 to 90% what they call minority school classroom. Okay. If it's at John Jay, I'll probably say it's an 80% white classroom.
Okay. I'll have to ponder. If you have any input, because I was waiting to write him back after I kind of got a little bit more detail from you. So if you have a choice in the matter, whether you would rather have him solo or doing it from the class where his students might potentially be participating. The only caveat I thought if he's doing
I would prefer to get him solo, because okay. He's really fine, man. I don't know if you looked at any of the videos. I mean, you can't even tell he's white when he talks. I mean, if he calls you, you'll swear you're talking to a black person.
Okay.
He has them fooled. So I don't know if that's because they'll probably try to defend him, you know.
Right on. Enough said. If you other comments you want to share, feel free. Thank you. I just wanted
to
get that.
Absolutely. I just wanted to add on. I wanted to say, thanks for the show, Gus. Good evening to you. Good evening to the gentleman who usually asks to do the prayer and Puff. And as to what Puff was saying, the school my kids go to, they don't have books either. It's sort of like they're being tracked. They get iPads. The teachers know everything that they're doing. We get calls sometimes, hey, they only did 30 minutes of this, study session. They need to log in an hour before this date. So we got to get on them to do that other half an hour work. So yeah, it's all tracking. As for the clips, the white teens, man, I never heard that ethnic intimidation. Like, man, that's a new one. I mean, have you heard that one before, Gus? That was a new one for me. Ethnic intimidation. Wow. The San Jose with the noose, with the bike used as a noose, and with the torture that young man went through. You covered that story quite well on the cows. I'm glad that that's going to case. I'm going to trial. But, I mean, did I hear right? They're only being charged with misdemeanors.
Correct.
Not felonies.
Correct.
I mean, it's something that's going to be expunged probably from there. No one will ever know that they were torturing this young man. And I feel like they should have been charged with felonies and do jail time behind what they did to him. That last story with the gynecology guy and his statue here in Central Park, I watched the Phil Valentine lecture years ago. He quite, prominently brought this guy up. I forget his name for the moment. But those three women, I mean, it sounded like sort of I got that Henrietta Lacks feel, I know that was before Henrietta Lacks, but, it was just like that feel where these women aren't going to get credit for all of the things that these people benefit from their experimentation, it just touched me in the wrong way. I like the strong language that man used during that segment about Jesse Owens. I never saw Jesse Owens, I just know about him what I've read or seen documentary-wise. I guess Carl Lewis was the Jesse Owens of my day, But Jesse Owens, I could just imagine what he had to endure. And every time I see the commercial now, I think of you, Gus, because you say, man, they just love to have the ability to pull out the Nazi flag and have some people dress up like Hitler. I mean, that's all this movie looking at. That's all I see in the commercial. And, just paying attention, just like, wow. And I can't think of any sport movies where they didn't focus on a white trainer or a white manager or a white coach or accountant or lawyer or some white person that was in this athlete's life who didn't go to the gym and work out for them or didn't, put in all the time and stuff they have to put in to be a great athlete. Some white person who just, gets the credit for it. And most of the movies, and I think it'll be this way until we have our own Hollywood, it will focus on the white person or they won't be able to put that movie out. And I think that was something that the guy was trying to say is when you put out the difference between a documentary and a movie is the movie has to be somewhat whitewashed. That they have to put that fantasy of that illusion of this good white person in them in order to put it out. Just an observation I made just watching the campaign and watching who wants to be the leader of the white supremacy administration here. A lot of them would ask questions about prison reform. And I was really interested listening to Scottie V's show, just really interested to hear that a lot of them have a problem with the private prison industrial industry, even though Scottie V's show pointed out that a lot of them taking donations from the private and prison industrial industry. But these questions always come up when it has to do with the white drug abuse problem. And, I mean, now, you know, they want to do away with drug crimes. Now that it's these white kids all strung out on heroin in the Midwest and up in the North, the I guess what they call New England area. So just really, like, how many, 20, 30 years of us just going to jail for selling drugs or getting high, or just look what it did to the black family. And now that it's white people, well, you know, let's just do away with these drug crimes. You got all these black people in jail who don't belong there, and they get these standing ovations. Like, it has to do with us, but this has to do with them. And, you know, just an interesting vote week as well, because everyone's trying to get the black vote. And just loving how that's playing out, just watching these confused black people, you know, go do the show, hit the stage with these people on the campaign stump, and, you know, argument about Bernie Sanders. He was arrested, you know, protesting in Chicago. And, I mean, I didn't even know they had newspapers when he was a kid. So it was funny, they pulled out a picture. I mean, there's no way we'll know if that's really him. I mean, look at him now. So it's just just hilarious to me how it's playing out and how black people are so so drawn to that Clinton. It just kills me. And I mute my line. Thank you very much, Gus.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to everyone. My first report would be on the Fort Lauderdale race soldier who is going about the means, and I think he's going to be successful in getting his job back. Keep in mind, to the callers, if you don't know, Chief Adderley, who is the director of Fort Lauderdale Police Force, is a non-white black male. Every time I see him being interviewed, he looks very flabbergasted of the whole incident, and he's probably thinking the same thing that I'm thinking, that this white male will get his job back. There is a recent precedent, although it's been going on for you know, a very long time, in white males getting their jobs back, or white people, period, getting their jobs back. But there's a recent precedent, probably no longer than a few months ago. I saw it on Yahoo. I just can't remember exactly where it's at, where a white enforcement official did get his job back for doing the very same thing. Jesse Owens, compare him directly with Joe Lewis. Because under the two non-white black people, under similar circumstances, are applauded by white people as being quote unquote American heroes, but yet at the same time, the very seat of power in this part of the world, both abused both individuals, Jesse Owens, James Cleveland Owens, and Joe Lewis had income tax problems that was induced on them directly by power people in this country. He also was manipulated into attempting to speak to the young people in 1968. Who were the young black people who were they weren't going to go to the Olympics, but since they went to the Olympics, they were going about the means of, well, if we win, we're going to make some kind of symbolic demonstration on the podium. And this was after Tommy Smith and John Carlos did their Black Power salute, and he was asked to go speak to them. He got cursed out in a turn, but later on about Jesse Owens, and I don't know if they would, well, I know they're not going to have this in the movie, he ended up agreeing with for basically speaking to them about not having some sort of thoughts or annual actions on trying to correct the problem of racism. He said he regretted it. Moving on, there's another documentary that came on, and this is also sports related, that was called The Forgotten Four. And actually, these are four non-white black males who supplied black males into the NFL after World War II. Kenny Washington, Woodrow Strode, Bill Willis, Marion Motley. Now, Bill Willis and Marion Motley had very successful NFL careers, both of them in the NFL Hall of Fame. Bill Willis and Marion Motley played on the same team, the Cleveland Browns. Ironically, Marion Motley, here's an act of racism, I suspect. Ironically, Marion Motley, after his football career, ended it. He wanted to be a coach. So where do you go? He went back to the coach that coached him for the Cleveland Browns, white male by the name of Paul Brown. He was turned down. He attempted to get jobs subsequently years later for the Cleveland Browns, and he kept getting turned down. He never could get a job. You know, all of the work that he'd done to make the Cleveland Browns a success from their inception in the early years, he wasn't able to capitalize for himself to make a living for himself and take care of his family in turn. Jim Brown had the NFL Channel had a what I thought was a documentary, ended up being a panel on marking his 80th birthday. And I think it was kind of like really put together. Everybody that was on the panel wasn't even born when Jim Brown was playing. And there are other black males who are still alive and vibrant that could have spoken more directly and more realistically on Jim Brown. And I also, in my opinion, would have had somebody on there like Spike Lee to be able to ask him some direct questions to get more constructive conversation. Because the only thing that managed to come out about that was when he made his reasoning on why he left the NFL. He once again, I've heard him say this too many times and I need to mention, he brought up the idea of I'm in a movie with who I think is a promiscuous white female, Raquel Welch, and that sort of thing. And so, I mean, it was just kind of like disgusting in a sense, because I really admire and respect Jim Brown, and I'm not talking about even from a football standpoint, or some of his ideas and some of the things that he had to say and do. And if that's all you can get out of a person in an hour, something like an hour and a half show, then that's really is not really getting the most out of what he has to offer. That's it for right now. Thank you.
Right on. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had a hand up, if you had commentary, feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus, to the callers and listeners. I don't have any commentary on the clips, but I did have a question because someone asked me this question and I couldn't answer it, so I figured I would ask you. How did you come up with the title for the program? And what's the significance of the cow. I couldn't answer that when someone asked me, so I figured you would be the best person to answer this question.
For sure. Before the program started, myself and others, but we were having conversations about racism, and it would happen with white people and non-white people. They would start giving responses or answers and talking as if there was no racism, as though, you know, whatever they were talking about, whatever the subject happened to be, as though this was happening in a space where there was no racism. And I felt like, I felt like I kept having to remind them, like, hey, we are in a system that is dominated by racism that is the primary factor producing whatever it is that you are talking about. And this just kept happening over and over and over. It was every day when this would come up. I felt like I kept having to interject and just say, we are in a context of white supremacy. It got to the point where I was doing it in front of other people, and we just started to fade out. It would just be in the context of white supremacy, and it was nothing else to say. It was just like what you are saying, the reason that, you know, we're talking about it in this way or being flustered is we're acting as though there is no system of racism. Once we come back that is the dominant force that we are functioning within, it makes sense why we're seeing what we're seeing or why we're having this conversation. But this was happening all the time. And it just got to the point that just became the abbreviation. Context of white supremacy, and just fade out. It really was nothing else to say. It became a running joke for the whole summer of 2007. So by the time we got to the end of 2007 and it was time to come up with this program to do a radio broadcast where we were going to talk about racism, and they said, well, what are we going to call it? It was, hey, we'll just call it the cows. That way we can use that as an acronym, and we don't have to tell white people exactly that it's going to be the context of white supremacy, but that's what it'll be. So we'll just call it the cows, and then we can alternate back and forth between saying cows, context of white supremacy. But that is how it came out, to just keep things rooted in the world that we live in is dominated by white supremacy, and to keep that in the forefront of our minds as we discourse.
Well, thank you for that. I feel that I'm having those same conversations with the people in my, you know, just comings and goings. So that helps a lot. I will mute myself until workplace racism, because I definitely have an update for that portion of the show.
For sure. I can also add in Neil Postman's book. I think I mentioned this on broadcast one when we came back to the air. So I guess it would be 7 years ago tomorrow. Neil Postman's book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, which is a outstanding book. And he has two books. Then he is a suspected racist, but that notwithstanding, in that book, he has like a whole section where he talks about context. And I read that book about 6 months before the cow started, where he talks about context being one of the most important factors when you are determining human behavior or you're trying to predict what people are going to do. Context. And in fact, in that book, he was making a critique of the way that the news is presented to us. He says most of the time, the thing on TV that is called the news, they give you no context. They just splash stuff up on the screen, and they're talking about this. It could be something that's happening across the country or around the world, and they just throw it up on the screen, and they talk about it for 60 seconds, and then they zip, now to the next topic, or they go to a commercial where they're, you know, advertising whatever, the music comes on, they go on. It's just no context at all. And he said it's very difficult. He invests a lot of time in talking about how when you read something, you have to have context. There's no way that you can read and make sense of what you're reading without context. Whereas television, you can totally erode context. You can just throw it out altogether. You can just splash stuff up that, you know, is not related at all, that doesn't make sense, that's not related. You can just do that, and it can become very difficult for you to grasp, to really deeply understand what's being presented once you begin to erode context. And that had a big impact on my thinking. Context is very important, and the major context that everything is happening on this planet is white supremacy. So that would be an additional where the title came from, the importance of context. Very, very important. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Can I do the prayer this evening?
Yes, sir. Just remind me if I forget.
Thank you.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings to you guys and to all the callers and the listeners.
I just wanted to start off just by picking up where you left off in regards to the cows. I always had a fascination with how you came up with the title of the show and the logo. And it was weird because shortly after Dr. Welsing passed away, I thought about it and the fact that you are using the cow's logo and the cow is an animal. And in Kemetic culture, one of the oldest female gods is Het-Heru, and her symbol is a cow. That is the deity that turned out to be the golden calf in the Bible. And also that tradition was carried to India, which is why they still worship the cow to this very day. And I found it very interesting because she's considered one of the quintessential mother figures. And to me, like, this show kind of feeds Black people's understanding of racism and white supremacy in the way that Het-Heru, which is her Kemetic name, basically fed the world. And also I found it very telling that Dr. Welsing had her book, The Isis Papers, which would, of course, allude to a set. And then you had the show The Cows, which symbolically for me alluded to Het-Heru. And in the Yoruba culture, Yemaya, which is the Nigerian variation in the Orisha tradition of Aset, and Oshun, which is the Yoruba variation of the deity Het-Heru, work very closely together, and they're both water deities in that tradition. So I just found that very fascinating. And I just wanted to kind of piggyback off of that. But to get to some of the other things I wanted to discuss, in the clip about political correctness, I found it interesting because a white male in that clip, I will paraphrase, but he basically said that political correctness was a way of controlling thought, basically how people express thoughts. And it brought me back to when you had Bob Lowe on the show and he discussed the fact that white people dominating music was about the control of ideas, which is, again, the control of thought and how we are allowed or not allowed to express thoughts and ideas. And basically that whole concept of political correctness for me was just a way of refining white supremacy. And like Puff was saying earlier, basically testing the public to see what you can get away with saying publicly versus what you cannot. And I agree with her emphatically with the fact that I believe everything that white people do are tests. No matter what it is, no matter how seemingly benign it is or how malignant it is, everything they do, they keep, like she said, they keep records. And over time, they develop these ideas and these based on the patterns that they see on the reactions of Black and non-white people to the things that they do to us or the ideas that they infuse into our culture and into our society. Also, I found it interesting, Thomas in New York brought this up, when he talked about in the clip where the Black male was beaten up, and I saw the actual video that you posted on your Facebook page in the train station. And also, I wrote down the term ethnic intimidation, and I found that to be basically a refinement of white supremacy, because basically you're saying it's white supremacy. But the term he used is, buckets and buckets of words, ethnic intimidation. And it is brand new. It's something I've never heard before, and I found that very fascinating. And then also, I remember I read an article about the same beating, and the white male who assaulted him actually said to the police, "Why are we being arrested? He's only a nigger." And they actually had that quoted in the article that I read, and I found it very interesting because this just, and this was a young white male. He looked like he was probably in his early to mid-20s. And again, we're under this assumption that if, the baby boomers just die off, magically racism and white supremacy is going to be okay, and, everything's going to be great between Black and white people. But these young people are the genetic, banner carriers of racism and white supremacy, and we're seeing it play out more and more every day, from Dylan Storm Roof to now this guy literally brutally assaulting this Black male. And then I found it very telling that in any other case, especially when there's a Black person or non-white person involved, if you were with that person and that person committed a crime and you did nothing to stop that crime or to report that crime, you would be considered guilty by complicity. Basically, you were there, you knew what was going on, and you did nothing about it. One of those other men stole his cooler, which he should have been arrested for theft. And then the other three basically were accomplices because they knew what he was going to do, and they did nothing about it, and they basically stood by and watched. And I thought about it, what if there was a train coming into the station when he decided to throw that Black male onto the tracks? This would be a totally different story, to be a dead Black man, and would they have walked for that? And I think more than likely they would have found a way to either reduce the sentence or let these white males walk. And I just found that pretty disgusting, but it's just what the system of white supremacy essentially, you know, does. This is how it functions. This is how it works. And I found it telling in the clip where you talked, where they talked about the house, I forget what part of the country that it was, that had the Confederate flag with the black doll hanging in a noose on the porch. And the white woman came out and said, well, I just wanted it to be removed. And, you know, now that it's gone, I'm satisfied with that. And I think the average black person listening to that clip would think she was a good white person. I'll put that in quotes. I hate that term. It's nauseating. And simply because she comes across in this so-called sincere tone, I think the average black person listening to that clip would probably think, oh, she's a decent white person. I saw it as her refining white supremacy. Basically, she's saying, don't be overt with it. You don't have to put a black doll in a noose and a Confederate flag. You can just go out and abuse black people instead. Like, why are you telling them what we're doing? And she did it in a seemingly benign way. So that's how I interpreted that clip. And then also I found it very interesting in regards to the Jesse Owens clip. In the commercial for that clip that they keep playing repeatedly, he says it's not about it's not about black and white. It's about who's fast and who's slow. And I equated that to the O.J. Simpson commercial they were playing before the O.J. Simpson miniseries came out, where he kept saying, I'm not black, I'm OJ. And again, these things are being done to basically, like you say, I love the term, obfuscate the facts about racism, white supremacy, and to get us to think that we're in this quote-unquote post-racial society and that it's not really about black and white, it's about fast and slow. You're talking about Hitler, you're seeing swastikas all throughout the commercial, which I can imagine what Jesse Owens went through in that environment, dealing with these psychotic, a stadium full of psychotic white terrorists, you know, and basically they have him saying, at least his character, saying that it's not about black and white, it's about fast or slow. It's always about black or white. And then they have this OJ clip with Cuba Gooding Jr. saying, oh, I'm not black, I'm OJ. And it's just a reinforcement of that kind of, basically, that kind of obfuscation of the actual facts of what racism, white supremacy really is. And then I found it interesting in the Blackskin, the clip where the young male talks about referring to himself as Blackskin. And there was a female who talked about designing clothes that she called mixed up clothing. And I just found it very interesting because this just reinforces confusion for non-white children. I just believe that a child should be raised to understand how they're going to be perceived in the world, in the system of racism and white supremacy, and how to act accordingly. However they choose to refer to themselves otherwise, that's a personal choice. But as far as parental responsibility, basically raise the child to understand this is how the world's going to see you, and this is how you're going to be treated based on the way the world's going to see you. And I just find it, just again, Dr. Wilson moment, just that confusion of telling children that have cultural, ethnic heritage from different parts of the world that they're mixed in some way. It's just totally confusing these children and leaving them open to abuse. Also, the clip on Dr. Marion Sims, I just found it very nauseating that he is revered and he would perform these procedures on black females without anesthesia. And after he's experimented on and tortured these females, he goes with white females and gives them anesthesia. And it's just disgusting that they would revere this person. But again, this is white supremacy. He has statues all over the country. And it's really interesting because they talked about him inviting people after a while to watch him perform surgeries. And I remember there's a show that comes on, and I think it's Stars or HBO, it's called The Nick, and it's basically about early medicine in New York City. And they show the early surgeries that were performed in New York City hospitals, and they also call it a theater, basically. And they have all of these doctors sit in a theater type of setting when they're cutting people open for different types of surgeries that are considered experimental that end up eventually becoming routine surgeries over time. And I just found it interesting because the term theater is basically a term of warfare. When America went to Iraq to bomb Iraq, they called that a theater of war. And I find it interesting that in the medical field, it's also warfare. And that's why they have a theater there where they're experimenting on black people. And that also even goes into politics, because they also they use the term campaign. Campaign is also a military term that is used in politics, but it's also a military term used in the military when they go to bomb or kill non-white people in other parts of the world. So basically, again, they're obfuscating the fact that we are in a war, and that's medical warfare, essentially, being performed on these black females. And I actually called it medical rape because these women were slaves, so they didn't have a say-so in what was being done to them. He basically was medically raping them and tampering with their sexual organs. And this is without anesthesia, and he's now revered for it. And it kind of brought me to the fact that a pattern that I see in racism and white supremacy is that whenever there's a white person, whoever the white person is, that does something quote-unquote good for society in some way, especially when it's dealing with medicine and things like that, you always find that there's some black person who's been abused, terrorized, and experimented on behind that white person. And like a previous caller said, no one ever discusses these people behind the success of this white person. And then whenever there's a black person that's successful, and this tends to be a pattern, especially in sports and athletics, there has to be, you know, he cannot make it without God, which is the white man behind him, which is why in 42, they had to play up the white man, which is why in Race, they're playing up the white man, which is why in Creed, they're playing up the white man. It's all about basically God has to be behind the black man, which is the white man, in order for that black man to become anything of note. And then when white people become quote-unquote successful, it's success at the expense of the lives of black people. And also, when I wanted to bring out something that Thomas in New York talked about, his children getting iPads from their schools, and I know some schools also provide laptops for their students, depending on what school the child goes to, because that happened with my son. And I just wanted to say, be very careful, because these devices have cameras. And I remember, I believe it was two summers ago, it might have been a little bit earlier than that, or a year or so later than that. But not too long ago, I remember there were children that were provided laptops by their school. This is elementary school students, in which the teachers were able to turn on the cameras and they would be able to see what was going on in that child's house. So if the child had a computer set up in their bedroom, they could actually remotely turn the camera on and be able to see what was going on in the child's home without them being aware. So I would just say, if you have like that cloudy kind of mask, cloudy plastic tape, put it over the camera so that even if they somehow remotely activate the camera, that they're not able to see in your home, it'll at least, you know, block their view from being able to see in your home and potentially spy on your household. That's something I just wanted to put out there. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Are there other folks that we have not heard from? If we haven't heard from you, you should go now before we get to workplace racism.
Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, everybody. Look, Gus, I wanted to call in, and when you mentioned when you played the monologue and the subject of biracial and multiracial came up, I am so sick of that argument. That is something that has plagued the African-American community forever. And the ones who call themselves multiracial, we all know what they're doing. They're trying to distance themselves from their blackness. They want to name all these ethnicities in hopes that they will somehow be viewed as something other than black. And I just think that today that's just something that just adds another problem. Well, it's not added another problem. It's another unresolved problem. And that, it also made me think about Beyonce and her performance at the Super Bowl, even though I didn't see. I saw it online. You know, you had all this, you know, caterwauling and yelling about her sending a message to the police and all this kind of stuff, when there was no such thing. The message in the performance was very, 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 very muted, in my opinion. If you look at the lyrics to the song that she was talking about, it is basically about materialism And she makes a reference to her Negro nose, but, you know, she's had rhinoplasty on her nose. I mean, she's had her nose fixed so that it will look more Caucasoid. And, of course, she wears the blonde hair. And this continues to be a problem, specifically among African-American women. I think African-American males have made tremendous strides in seeing representations that look like them. I mean, we have a number of dark-skinned African-American males in acting. However, dark-skinned black women have not been able to break through that. During the 60s, when black was beautiful for a hot minute, we did have a few dark-skinned actresses. Judy Pace was one. Brenda Sykes was another. Naomi Sims is the first so-called black supermodel. She appeared on the issue of Life magazine in 1968, and she is dark-complected. However, if you look at all of the representations of black females, just go and look at some of the chorus lines of the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. You see the pattern is, you know, if you are light-complected, then you are the object of beauty. And that has not changed today. What killed the 60s, when we had that brief period where dark-skinned women were being lauded somewhat as beautiful, that ended with hip-hop. And you had these hip-hop artists they began to hire Puerto Rican women to be love interests in the videos and light-complected women. And that never, never, never stopped. And so now we're here with Beyonce and Rihanna and Halle Berry, and nothing has changed. And I want to recommend a book, and I thought it was a black woman who wrote it, but it wasn't. It's written by a Canadian woman, actually, named Patricia Morton, and she wrote a book called Disfigured Images, and it gives a pretty concise history this whole issue of how black women, how this issue of beauty and how, you know, the lighter skin woman became the example of all black women. And, you know, and it's not just African Americans. If you look at the Miss Universe pageant, that is a perfect example of white supremacy. The countries don't send women who really represent the essence of their country. They send women who look the closest to like white women. So that's basically all I wanted to say.
Right on. I think that came an issue in one of those pageants down in Brazil where it was a black female that won, and she talked about all the racism that she got and how that obstructed her success in the pageants. That was a big issue, I think, within the last week or 10 days, if I'm mistaken, but very, very recent and got a lot of attention. Anybody that we have not heard from, if you had a hand up and we have not heard from you, you should go.
Good evening. I would like to, I don't want to belabor the point of Beyonce's performance during Super Bowl, but I just don't see the talk with the media, social media, stuff like that, saying that, of course, with Beyonce getting all the publicity, working for, you know, major record companies and stuff like that, whenever you even compose a song or make a song, you have to get that, like, that has to be, go through so many people, which I'm sure is going to be a lot of white people that have to, you know, say, hey, that's a good song. We're going to go with that. And, of course, the performance as well. You know, I'm sure that had to be okayed by quite a few white people. So it's not like, you know, people are talking as if, just like, you know, we were talking about context earlier. There's no context behind it. So I'm sure Beyonce didn't just go up there and just do a rogue, you know, performance on her own in a song that just she just kept a secret she made in a secret studio. Just went out there and performed this way with, no white people saying okay in it. So I think we definitely need to look at that and figure out, you know, when white people allow stuff to go out to the masses, there's a definitely another reason behind it. And I just don't see a lot of talk on the media. Of course, they're not going to discuss that, but not saying like, hey, this had to be okayed by a lot of powerful suspected racists. A couple of the callers were mentioning earlier.
Oh, are you still with us, sir? Might have been disconnected. I'll wait for him to dial back, or if he's having audio problems, the caller I was just speaking about. Oh, it looks like he did get disconnected. Anybody else that we missed while he's dialing back in who hasn't been able to share yet, if you wanted to go, if we have not heard from you?
Hello?
If you could speak up, M1, your volume is kind of low.
Okay. Hi. I'll be quick. Today, this wasn't in your clips, but today in Chinatown in New York City, where I live, there was a rally for convicted killer cop Peter Liang. And the tagline was accident, not crime. Basically, it's what we discussed earlier on how people of his community, Asian Americans, Chinese, however you want to describe them, I feel that Peter Liang is a victim of racism and would not be treated this way if he is a white officer. I totally agree with that. But again, it does not excuse the crime he committed. And it was not an accident, because anybody who shoots, you are taught there is no such thing as an accidental discharge. You purposely did it. You put your finger on the trigger. You may not have seen what you did, but you still did it. So there's no such thing as an accidental discharge. So you can't allow that to become the narrative. And political correctness. Basically, this is just white people wanting to be racist without being punished. And then what is really offensive is this idea that somehow people are really being restricted on saying whatever. Like, you can't say offensive things now. Like the common argument, how certain movies like Blazing Saddles, The Jerk, could not be made today. And I'm like, this is the furthest from the truth. Do we not just see very offensive movies make a whole lot of money? Movies that you wouldn't call politically correct in any sense of the term. You know, you have politicians making what we call non-political correct statements, and it's being tolerated. I mean, and let's not forget all of the things said about President Obama. And then what's really interesting is, on the one hand, people who say they're against political correctness they're quick to condemn something Trevor Noah says. Like Ted Cruz says, he's against political correctness, but although it was so wrong to call his daughters monkeys, I mean, why didn't he just go along with it? After all, that guy was just expressing his opinion, right? Why be political correct on that? You know, the whole thing with Killer Mike. Now, where are all the people that are anti-PC for that? Or there was this rapper, also not too long ago, who was actually on trial for singing about a song. Supposedly the song had details of crime. He did not take part in this crime any way, shape, or form. He just sang about it, and as white people do, they found some obscure law to put this man on trial for murder. Ultimately, the case was thrown out, but I was like, wait a second, what about his freedom of expression? I mean, to go to jail over a song, you would think all the people that are against PC, especially Mr. Bill Maher, you would think this would be their rallying call, but no. It's just some black guy, so just let him burn. And, you know, that's it, and keep up the good work on the program.
Appreciate that. So I know you mentioned last week, I saw another enforcement officer was shot and killed in Mississippi today by a white man. And I didn't see a parade of the usual suspects out to talk about what a disgrace this is and the war on cops. And I didn't see any of that. This just happened within the last 24 hours in Mississippi. It was quite a few news outlets. They did have stories about it, but none of the typical outrage when it's a non-white person who commits one of these acts. Anywho, transitioning to workplace racism, folks have commentary. The number again is 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Workplace racism, if folks have things they would like to share. Again, if you have figured out something that works well to minimize problems on the job and get racists up off of you or minimize conflict with other non-white people on the job, outstanding. If you have observations, and as one of our listeners has said before, if you recall things that have happened previously in your work experience where maybe something happened and you didn't have an understanding of racism that you have now, so you recognize that and you see how it played out in this particular situation, and okay, this is how I handled it then when I was a little bit more confused, this is what I would do now that I have a better understanding of racism, that would probably benefit a lot of folks as well. But if folks have commentary on workplace racism, feel free.
Hey, Gus.
Yes, ma'am.
Hey, just kind of repeat what you said about Mississippi. Somebody got shot in Mississippi?
It was an enforcement officer. I think they were, if I'm remembering correctly, I can look and get the exact article, but it was, I think, a white man, and it was some sort of hostage situation with his family, and the enforcement officers arrived to deal with the whole situation, and it ended up being a shootout, and he ended up shooting back and killing one of the enforcement agents. This was in Mississippi, I believe, over the last 24 hours, if I'm not mistaken. I can look in. I guess I can post the article on Facebook.
Now that you mentioned it, the details, I kind of remember them saying something yesterday about that. That was in Iuka, Mississippi, which is in the very, very top north corner, almost bordering Alabama and Tennessee. Yeah. Okay, now I know what you're saying. Okay, I thought something had happened in Jackson. I was like, oh, okay, what happened? But I didn't hear about anything because I live here now. So
okay,
yeah, I thought that something had happened in Jackson, but I do remember them saying that yesterday on the news. Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt, but workplace racism. Go ahead.
For sure, the officer sorry that was that. Killed. Not a problem. The officer that was killed was James Lee Tart, T-A-R-T-T, and the white shooter was Charles Lee Lambert, where he had taken his wife and 10-year-old daughter hostage. Make sure that's plastered out as well. White people doing it up, white on white crime. Workplace racism. Folks have commentary?
Well, I have something.
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, everyone. You know, just since I've been listening to your show, I've been thinking, you know, wow, seems like since I live in such a small, tiny place that I should be able to, you know, wrest control of this place for the benefit of, you know, my friends and family, since we are smarter and we are better, at least that's what I think. But since I started doing that, you know, everything's just gotten really shaken up a lot. You know, Ms. Bland died and the councilman got tased and everything's just really vibrating on a higher plane. So anyway, so what's happening now, and I wouldn't have understood this if I hadn't listened to Dr. Welsing, but in order to get the sheriff out, you know, whose jail Ms. Bland died in, there's something happening. And so now we have a lot of cartoons. The sheriff is portrayed with a Pinocchio nose, a very long nose, you know, on the internet, liar, liar, pants on fire. And the cartoon made of, you know, the sheriff and the deputies and the DA dancing in a little Speedo, you know, jockey shorts and stuff like that, like cartoon characters. And so I'm seeing a real push. And so the candidates who know that the sheriff is just shark bait now. Ms. Bland, you know, the sheriff who was over the jail when Ms. Bland was found hanged, is just shark bait. So, you know, the guy who's running for his position, the white guy, he's standing by me all day today, and he's like, you know, I think you're just wonderful, and I really want to help you. If you like, I'll pass out your political flyers for you. Now, this is, you know, the guy who's running for the Deep South chair. He says, you know, and in that way, you can go other places and do things. And, I mean, do you need some help with your chairs? Do you need some help with your tables? You know, and it's just all coming together, just like, you know, Dr. Welsing said. If you make the sheriff an object of, you know, comedic ridicule, everyone jumps on board. Everyone wants to get in, you know, a knife dig. So he really is on his way out, and the DA is a couple of steps behind him, and so is the judge, and they know it. But I keep watching the ridicule build and build and build, you know, into making them characters where you have no sympathy or empathy for them. And then they're just going to, you know, in the next election, they're just going to trash them, which is pretty unusual as, you know, anyway. So that's what I am observing. I wouldn't have noticed that would be what's playing out. Oh, and I think that you misunderstood what I said about the three sheriff vehicles rolling up on me. It was very unusual because instead of it being like ants, you know, attacking a piece of cookie or something, it was like oil and water. It was like, you know, they rolled up and they rolled off, which is not what their usual modus operandi is. That was very unusual. They like did not want to engage, did not want to stop. Just wanted to keep going, you know, and that's what I was saying was very unusual. Not that they showed up en masse, that's the usual thing, but the thing that they just rolled off, that's very unusual. So that's where I am.
Okay, I got it. I have better clarity about the enforcement officer incident. We could watch the metaphors, folks. Watch the metaphors. No metaphors on the Saturday program. And we are on workplace racism, so we can stay on task. That would be grand. Workplace racism. If folks have commentary to share, feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to give an update. I'm
calling from Michigan, and I have been employed at a law firm since December the 16th. Last week, I was sharing about our lunch at the bar, and I remember ending my commentary last week with, I don't think I will be there long. And I believe yesterday was my last day. So December the 16th is when I started last year. I got a promotion January the 15th, and I was to manage a white female who, once I got promoted within that month to be the manager over her, she was fired 2 weeks after. And this past Tuesday, I was being written up because they told me I was responsible for her. And it was because it was under my watch that all the things that she did fell through the cracks. Those were the words they said. And then they wanted me to sign the write-up, and I refused to sign the write-up. I said that, well, I need a little more detail as to what you are actually accusing me of. Like, what didn't she do that I didn't follow up on? You know, I was just asking for more detail, and I gave a lot of pushback to being written up just totally out of the blue on Tuesday. And so the attorney that was that's the manager told me, well, give me 24 hours and I will have the list for you. Well, within those 24 hours, two non-white, non-black associate attorneys resigned. They are classified as Chaldeans, and they were being heavily mistreated at the law firm, and they were actually the attorneys that I was supporting in the law firm. They resigned, and so within that 24-hour period, she didn't come back and give me the list. It was a lot of chaos between that Wednesday through Friday, which was yesterday, and she never came back. But what I did notice was there was no conversation with me. No one said anything to me between Wednesday and Friday. It was like, no good morning, no good evening, no anything. It was like I totally wasn't there. I also know that on Friday before I left, they asked me for my keys to the office. They also disabled all my accounts, but I didn't get called into the office to get fired. I'm just anticipating that is going to happen on Monday. So typically I can log into all of my accounts from home to check the calendars for the attorneys and things like that, but I have no access to anything, and I also can't get in the building. So I am just trying to decide, should I go in and give them the pleasure of firing me or just not show up at all? Because I know that it's over, which I'm not, I mean, I'm okay with, but it's just interesting that I started December the 16th, and I kind of knew that this wasn't a fit for me. And I'm, again, coming from a background of working for myself, working from home, coming back into this workplace with the being less confused is really challenging. And I was there again for, 2 months? I stayed to myself. I gave them just, 4 days' work, but I didn't communicate. I remember one of the white females told me I make her very uncomfortable because I'm too quiet, but I gave, I was just working, and I just wasn't a fit. And so I'm just interested in seeing, it's just interesting because, again, I knew it wasn't going to work, and Monday I know that, they're just going to take the pleasure of firing me. Now, on Tuesday, when I was being written up, the attorney was very upset that I wouldn't sign the write-up. And she was really angry. She, was like, you just need to sign it. You were responsible for, the white girl, the white female that was fired. And she was just shocked, I guess, that I didn't just willingly sign it. And in the midst of her getting this, the details together, the two non-white, non-black attorneys resigned. And I must admit that I did have a part in them resigning, just kind of empowering them and telling them, you know, just our conversations about the things that were being done to set them up for malpractice. So they ended up resigning, which was kind of a shock to the entire firm. But overall, I am more than likely fired. And I don't know if I want to give them the pleasure of just, you know, telling me that on Monday or just not showing up. So that's the update. And just, it's pretty interesting being back in this work field. So just wanted to share that.
Wow. That has come up, the write-up. I think it was Thomas in New York where that came up as a serious issue, particularly if there is, if you contest where you think, you know, there's some mistreatment or they're not being clear in terms of you allegedly being written up for some sort of misconduct or you didn't do this correct or you violated policy. That should be a question, I guess, that we ask at the beginning of, you know, starting at a new job, place of employment. If they do have a system of write-ups, are you required to sign? If there is a dispute or disagreement about the write-up, can you decline signing just to get, you know, clarification on that policy from the very beginning? What's the procedure if you say, hey, I don't agree with this, I have a different assessment of the situation, and, you know, I do not want to sign as though I am agreeing to this? What's the procedure and how that's handled? That might be something to get clarification at the beginning of a new process of employment. The thing that also stood out, I think, when you first shared all this about this white woman that they were trying to get rid of anyway, because she was pregnant and they, you know, wanted to go ahead, I guess, and bump her off the payroll, where they said it seemed like a part of getting rid of her was, we'll put you, black female, we'll give you, you'll be her supervisor, in hopes that that helps, you know, push her out of the door. I would hope that non-white people that are listening to the program, black people, keep that in mind. If you, you know, have problems or if you yourself are a black supervisor, this tends to happen regularly for the black supervisor, the black person that is in charge. The white people that are really in charge, they get rid of them whenever they feel like it. This happens all the time. Oh, you didn't do this right. You didn't do that right. Particularly if it seems like this black this quote-unquote black supervisor is trying to help other non-white people and help minimize mistreatment or help them move along and progress on the job. Like, oh, man, that is not what we put you in charge to do. You are supposed to be, you know, laying it down, mistreating them, going along with our corporate strategy, which is generally just going to be practicing racism, white supremacy in a variety of ways, directly, indirectly. But that is interesting how all of that played out in relatively short period of time in between lots of binge drinking that you shared about before. But folks have any commentary, and Thomas is with us as well, any commentary on whether you would go in at all, how you would proceed for the upcoming week or the write-up situation? Folks have any thoughts on that? Yes, sir, we can hear you. The male caller who wanted to do the prayer will get you, and then the other caller as well.
Okay. In terms of her, the lady just, she is within her right not to sign any write-up. What can they do to her? They can just say she refused to sign or decline to sign. You also might be able to write a rebuttal as to what they are claiming that you are doing. A lot of times employees don't know what their rights is because the companies will not share that information with them. And most of us sometimes don't think about those things. We rely on the people who are mistreating us the most to give us the information that we need, and they do not. If you refuse to sign, you're within your right to refuse to sign, and you can write a rebuttal to be attached to whatever they're claiming you fail to do. And let them know that you want your rebuttal attached. In terms of going in to give them the satisfaction of firing you? I mean, that's a good question. I think you should kind of ponder on that, and you'll come up with the best decision for yourself.
There was, I think, another male caller who had input they wanted to share.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I was actually going to piggyback off of the previous caller and say the same thing. She doesn't have to sign a rebuttal. I've done that in the past as well. When you sign a rebuttal, as far as how most jobs look at it, they look at it as if you agree with whatever they wrote. So if I don't agree, I don't sign it. I actually write a rebuttal, and I state from the very beginning, you know, that this is a rebuttal. I refuse, and that I refuse to sign the document that was provided to me, and this is why. And I just go into that whole spiel. But yes, also I was going to say, in regards to going into work for them to fire you or not, it just kind of reminds me of Rome, because Rome, whenever they would conquer a people, they would like to take the king and parade them before the Roman people, where they would get berated and they would throw things at them and basically just totally abuse them before they would put them to death. So it kind of gave the entire country the ability to have fun practicing white supremacy on you know, the king of whoever they vanquished, whatever people they vanquished. So to me, when you come to the job with an understanding that they're going to let you go, it's like their way of putting you on parade. Then they bring the security guard in, they watch you pack your boxes, and then they're whispering at you and watching you while you're walking out the door. So, again, like the previous caller said, make that choice for yourself. It sounds like you have a pretty good idea of what might be to come. For me, I probably wouldn't show up. That's just my own personal thing. But, yeah, I would definitely piggyback with the rebuttal and refusal to sign the document as well. That was a great thing. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Your volume is a little low, Thomas, in New York. If you could speak up.
Yes, sir. Can I be heard now?
That is better.
Yes. Yeah, I definitely, and I agree with not signing. I know that's the right, but I've never had success using that tactic. I always put you on the line to be next. I would definitely show up to work, because by you not showing up, that can affect your unemployment. If you are expecting to, you know, collect unemployment, to actually get fired is one thing, but to just not show up looks like you quit. And, you know, they would love not to make sure that you have any money going forward. So I would definitely show up and let them do their job. And, you know, take it in grace, you know. And that's my comment on that. And the gentleman who spoke right before Roz, I remember he had a situation. I don't think he ever came on with the solution he came up with. I think he had to mediate something, or with someone who came to him that needed his help at in a workplace situation. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
I just also wanted to say that in my just trying to decide whether I was going to go in on Monday, I was going to call in. Again, everything has been disabled. I have no key to get in the building, and I'm usually the first person in the building on Monday. And specifically on Mondays, I go in early. And they took my keys on Monday, saying we're changing the lock, because the two non-black, non-white associates resigned. But I, you know, told the lady, I'm like, if you're changing the locks, why are you taking the keys? You should be passing out new keys instead of taking the keys that we have. That doesn't make sense. And once, you know, she was just very animate about getting my key. So, you know, I kind of was like, okay, that doesn't make sense. And then I gave her the key, and then I tried to log into my email and to my calendar and all the things that allow me to get prepared on Mondays, and I can't get into anything. Everything has been disabled. But I wasn't going to I was just going to call in and see what happened. Because like you said, I think Thomas from New York just said, you know, I don't want it to affect unemployment, but then I thought about, you know, I don't even know if I'm qualified for unemployment for 2 months. I have to just kind of really research. I was going to use Monday to do that, but and then there was a caller who was also saying the parading situation, and I definitely agree with that, because last week one of the attorneys that and I've mentioned him before. This was the attorney that is always, you know, he was the one that was, you know, he's a heavy drinker. He caused the spectacle at the bar back in December. He's the one who gave the black penis to be for the gift. He was out on vacation, and he is also the attorney that is always in the room anytime there is somebody to be quote unquote checked. He's like the overseer, I would say. He's always there to, you know, give the female attorney, I would just say, courage, because she gets really tough around this particular white attorney, and he was on vacation. Also, a lot of the gossipers were out on Friday. So Monday, it will be like their total territory. The two associate attorneys that I was actually supporting, they're gone. I know that I was supporting them as far as just like, you know, saying, hey, you don't have to take this. And maybe I shouldn't have been encouraging them and empowering them, but I just saw the mistreatment. Shame on me for, you know, being in a situation where I'm, you know, just like kind of nauseated at the mistreatment of non-white people. And it just, and I'm really trying to figure out how to balance that. So, and in the midst of me doing that, they quit. And it shook up the firm. It totally put them in a situation like they have a malpractice lawsuit that they have to try to fix. I mean, it's really they're in a situation that's bad. But I know now, like Monday, it will give them all pleasure to just to really, like, you know, take all the frustration out on me. So I was just gonna call in sick and see how that works out, because I know I can't even get in the building if I try. So thanks for letting me share. And but that will be, I know this is the end of this fiasco.
I have some encouragement for the caller. I once quit, and I didn't tell them that I quit. I did what you were planning on doing. I called in sick for days and days, and eventually the people told me they didn't know whether I had quit or not for weeks, because I left some shoes and a sweater and a couple of things on the desk, and I already had another job by the time they called me to tell me they were going to have to let me go. So, I mean, if it's any consolation, just, you know, to be mean and wicked, you just call in for a few days and just go about your life and get another job, and you don't have to tell them that you quit, and they'll be waiting and waiting to tell you that you're no longer employed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I believe that was Thomas from New York who inquired about what happened with that.
Your volume is a little low, too. If you could speak up, please, sir.
Okay, I believe that was Thomas in New York who inquired about... Can you hear me now?
Much better.
Who inquired about what happened with that case with the woman who I mediated on, who claimed that she was mistreated in the workplace. Ultimately, what happened was the analyst made a good case in her defense. She was the white manager, backed off of her for a couple of months, I guess 1 or 2 months, and the analyst was satisfied with the mediation that took place where I was involved in. Ultimately, after a couple of months, the situation reoccurred, and the analyst was transferred to another area, which I believe she was satisfied with the outcome. But it was a real struggle for her after the mediation, and the white manager backed off of her for a while, but then the issue started to resurface, and ultimately the department transferred her, which
resulted in a satisfactory situation for the analyst. And thank you for bringing that up, because I had forgotten that I had shared that situation with the program and didn't share the outcome of it.
For sure. That in the archives, where I think she had audited them and found that they were making errors, they hadn't been doing the correct thing, and then she ended up working with the same people that she had audited and picked out these errors. That was the situation?
Yes, it was.
Right. Yeah. That dig back in the archives, good memory. Thomas in New York. If other folks have workplace racism, feel free. I just wanted to get in again, just the so much of racism, white supremacy is premeditated. I just, you know, I say that all the time about coincidences, that generally whites, particularly if we're talking about, you know, white people that are attorneys, these folks generally, you have to go to do a lot of schooling and what have you, and do some thinking if you're going to be an attorney or involved with law. Just to me, the scheming of all of this, I don't know if you were aiding the non-white males, letting them know that they were being mistreated and trying to help them out also. But to me, it totally seems like if we want to get rid of this white female anyway, she's pregnant and we don't want to deal with maternity leave or whatever with all that, we want to get rid of her, we'll get this black female and say that she is the supervisor, quote unquote, of this white woman that we want to get rid of, and then we can get rid of all of them. Because we want to get rid of the white woman, and then we'll put whatever errors this white woman, she's got on our nerves, and we just don't want to be bothering her anymore, we'll put those errors on this black female, and we can get rid of everybody all in one swoop. That tends to be, I think, the way that racists operate, particularly more powerful. The racists that are more refined have a better grasp of the practice of white terrorism. I can totally see that in them. Particularly, we want to string this out and not just go ahead and get rid of her all at once. We'll string this out until next week when we have total staff here so we can all laugh and mock her as she's going to be fired and whatever other nasty things that we want to do in this whole process. That just seems to be the way that and then we can all go out and have drinks and celebrate, you know, the way that we worked our plan. That tends to be the way that I see whites operate. I could be in error, but that's just something to keep in mind. And I would say especially something to keep in mind for folks who want to get frustrated with black supervisors, in quotes, because they are victims, too. They are not in charge. I wouldn't care what your title is or how high up the quote-unquote chain of command you think you're going. We are still in a system of white supremacy. That just should be kept in mind.
Gus, I had a quick question for the female caller that was telling her, telling us her. If I remember correctly, you were saying that they gave you work to pile upon her to that they knew would be impossible for her to finish. If I remember correctly, if that's true, then in reality, the stuff that they're blaming you for that she didn't do was work that they basically gave you to set her up to fire her in the first place. And that's where a rebuttal would really, you know, make a lot of sense, simply because everything you did was at the behest of these people, these white women, white terrorists, telling you to do this to this other white female, and now they're blaming you for the stuff that she couldn't finish, that they knew she couldn't finish when they told you to put that work on her in the first place. Am I correct?
You are very correct. They definitely told me to overload her, pile her up. And then when she was fired, the attorney that was trying to get me to sign the write-up, she called me and said, I need you to stop what you're doing immediately and tell me what all the things that she didn't do that you told her to do. Like, I need you to write it up, because she went to the white female that got fired. I guess she's suing them because she's saying, oh, you guys fired me because I was pregnant, blah, blah, blah. And so they're trying to, you know, say, you know, she wanted me to help them defend the firm. And then they turned around and blamed me for her not doing her job. So when I gave pushback, that's when everything went downhill. So, yeah, you're right. It's crazy.
Yeah, because I kind of thought what Gus was thinking. In the very beginning, I was like, they wanted to do a full court press as far as getting rid of everybody. And I was like, well, wait a minute. I remember her saying they specifically gave her work that they knew this white female could not accomplish. with the intention of utilizing that to fire her. Again, like Gus just said, premeditated. Wow, just fascinating. Also, Gus, I had a question for the callers, because it's something that I experienced, not at work, but in traveling home from work. I noticed I ride the New Jersey Transit Northeast Corridor, which is the busiest train system in the country. And what I notice regularly is white males riding the train. This is something that has come up over the entire winter season for me, but I just started picking up on it. Riding the trains after work, whether it's weekdays, doesn't matter what day of the week, all the way through to a Friday, with open cans of liquor, whether it's beer or something like that, on the train, drinking it, and no one says anything. Even like the conductors that come through to collect your tickets don't say anything, but I just noticed, like, it doesn't matter the day of the week, once it's after hours at work, like, they're traveling with open cans of beer, and they're just sitting there drinking it, stinking up the whole area smelling like alcohol. And I just wanted to know if anybody else notices that wherever in the country that they're located. Thank you.
Commuter observations. Commuter observations. Anybody? I guess you'd have to be in some sort of public transit, or I guess maybe you could be paying attention to people as they're driving. But any observations on the white commuters' alcohol consumption? Fascinating. I know we have a lot of New York listeners. I would think we'd have other people that are taking on the train or the subway or whatever the case may be.
Can you repeat the question?
I was asking if you notice after hours, like let's say after work hours, any time of the week, if you notice white males walking around with open cans of alcohol, whether it's beer, a can of beer or a bottle of beer. But I noticed that quite a bit over the winter season, and more frequently in the last week. I was just like, wow, why are these men? And it would smell up the whole area of the car that we were sitting in, would smell like beer or whatever it is. And no one would say anything, not even the conductors. When they're walking through the train, the white man sitting there drinking his beer, and it's just like what it is. It's just no big deal. Sometimes it's multiple guys in the same car that I'm riding in, and they have open, alcoholic beverages, and no one says anything. And they're getting toasty on the train. So I just wondered if anyone else might have noticed that, if they use public transportation or anything like that.
Well, I absolutely noticed it. More prevalent during baseball season. After work, when the Yankees have a game, man, they're already lit up before they get to the stadium. I'll get on that train, like the D or the 4. Anytime I catch a train that goes that way. Nothing but parts of white people already drunk. Still got their suit on, but a Yankee hat, ready for the game. Got their alcoholic beverage exposed. Police don't give them a ticket. They start talking to them about the game, about the team, like nothing.
Seattle has a lot of commuting as well, but they have lots of bars, lots of coffee shops, and lots of bars. So generally you'll see the massive swarming to the bar areas. You can go and liquor up there, and then you can hit public transit. But I have to pay attention to see if that sort of thing is happening as well, where they just have it in hand on the bus or train or whatever. I have to pay more attention to that over the next few weeks, days, what have you. With that, we did our three. We will be back early tomorrow. For me, it'll be in the morning. We'll be back in about 12 hours, exactly 12 hours. We'll have our Global Sunday Talk on Racism tomorrow. Participation certainly encouraged from folks who are in different parts of the globe. Chime in. It is brief, 90 minutes, relatively brief. But always grand to hear from folks different parts of the world, hear their views, thoughts, observations on racism. Will certainly be good with the election season happening in this part of the world, the Zika virus, lots to talk about. We'll be here tomorrow, 12 noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific. And that's back-to-back. I'm not a morning person, but that is back-to-back. We'll be here early. Monday, James Wavelin, this is a white male, UK. He wrote the book The Zong. For the people who have been following the book club, The Half Has Never Been Told, that book is referenced there. But
In fact, they talk about the guy, Granville Sharp. They talk about him specifically, how this guy worked against slavery, and he did all this and helped stop slave trade in England. And then a white guy was named after him, and they were hoping that he would end up becoming a quote-unquote abolitionist, and he would work against slavery, and this guy ended up selling black people too. But that book was mentioned specifically there. It is fascinating. Again, just the short story recap of it is slave ship. The Zong pirates, white people, stole this ship from another set of white people. It already had black people on it, about 200 of them. They got an additional 200 from the continent, so it's approximately 400. They're supposed to be going to Jamaica. They make an error where they think that it's the island of Saint-Domingue, Haiti, Dominican Republic. They think that's what it is, but it's actually Haiti, Jamaica, where they're supposed to be going. So they keep going past Jamaica. It takes them, I think, a week before they realize their error. So they turn around. They report that they don't have enough water. And so the logical conclusion, we need to get rid of some of the Negroes. They end up approximately killing about 150 black people in three stages. Just toss them overboard. Who cares? And the only reason that this becomes a big deal is because the white people who own this ship decide that they want to be compensated for the lost Negroes that they killed. They want the insurers to pay that loss off. And so this goes to court, and that's how this becomes a big deal. And they have paintings about this. I'll see if I can post one of the pictures, because an artist did a painting of this. It's if we have listeners in Massachusetts, I think this painting is in a museum in Boston, so you can go see the depiction of this massacre, but that's what the book is about, and the trial that ensued afterwards, and what this reveals about racism, white supremacy. The author has the same view that I would have. Why would I be surprised that these white people were compensated for killing these black people? Why would that be a shock? And he even stipulates that this was not abnormal, that, you know, they killed black people on these slave ships all the time because they mutinied or for whatever reason. They got on our nerves, whatever, that, you know, this was routine practice. So why did this even become a big deal at all? That, so what? They killed 150 of them? So what? But that should be Monday. Always great to have white people on the program. For those who can tune in live, feel free, but it is going to be earlier than our normal broadcast time. Again, it should be 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific. So that'll be back-to-back days that we are on abnormally early. Anywho, if you have questions, problems, gripes, feel free, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. 7-year anniversary is tomorrow. If you can tune in, 7 years that we've been on the program, hopefully providing constructive information about what racism is, how it works, what it means to be white. But feel free, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. We'll try to get things cleared up if you have questions or problems. With that, thanks to everyone for tuning in. I hope it was a great investment of your Saturday evening. I again encourage sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. I discourage being around intoxicated whites. I discourage being around intoxicated non-white people. I definitely, if you're going to be behind the wheel, driver, passenger, even as a pedestrian, you do not want to be under the influence. Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson might be the one that's pulling you over. We definitely want to make sure that we are clear-minded, lucid, so we can make the best possible decisions, keep ourselves safe, and anybody else that we might be responsible for. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of free. Oh, caller was going to do the prayer. Glad I caught myself. If you're going to do the prayer, sir, feel free.
Yes, I am. But before I begin, Gus, I just want to say one thing to you, and this is to echo what Carmen, I believe, said at one time. Whether you know it or not, you are helping black people in a tremendous way, and I personally appreciate the work that you do. Creator, black people, we are in a system of racism, white supremacy. Creator, help black people to understand that white people practice racism, white supremacy in all areas of people activity, economics, education, entertainment, health, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war for the ultimate purpose of white genetic survival and to prevent white genetic annihilation on planet Earth. Creator, help black people to systematically transform their behavior for the purpose of justice and to guarantee that no black person is mistreated and to guarantee that the black person that needs help the most gets the most constructive help. Creator, thank you for Dr. Francis Quest Welsing in my lifetime. Creator, help black people resolve and remedy the problems of racism, white supremacy, and to replace it with justice immediately.
Ashe. Context of white supremacy. Signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.